This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Good morning, everyone. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Can you believe that it's Friday already? Where has the week gone? I feel like I walked in here an hour ago, and it was Sunday night into Monday morning. This is a week, maybe it's just me, but this is a week that has just flown by. And for our purposes, that means you get to ask me any question about anything you like as we start the first hour of each and every Friday show. You can call in and ask anything about anything. 800-848-9222 is the telephone number because it's time for
The Other Side of Midnight proudly presents Ask Frank.
Ask Frank Anything.
Ask Frank Anything.
Ask Frank Anything.
Ask Frank Anything.
So what does that mean? If you're new to the show, it means you can ask, hey, Frank, what's your opinion about a consumption tax? You can also ask, hey, Frank, what moves do the New York Metropolitans need to make next year in order to not be as miserable as they were last year? You can ask, Frank, what was your favorite Woody Allen movie? You can ask, Frank, what was the name of your third grade teacher? You can ask, what advice would you give me about dealing with an aging parent or an unruly nephew? Whatever question you have about any subject, I will do my best to answer it. You have questions about radio, politics, gambling, cocktails, motion pictures, you name it. I am ready to do my best and answer it. Doesn't mean I will be able to, but I'll try. 800-848-9222. Sometimes you might just ask a question that I don't know the answer to. And if that's the case, then I'll do my best to find out what the answer is. But we'll do the best we can. 800-848-9222. And one of the things we did 2 weeks ago, which I forgot to do last week, was we continued this, because this is a popular segment, we continued this in the Facebook group. And after the WABC early news was over, but before our Friday post-show meeting started, I answered questions in the Facebook group. So we're going to do that again. That'll be, so if we don't get your question asked this morning between 1 and 2, we'll do it again between 6 and 7, but you have to join the Facebook group. Just go on Facebook and search Morano Radio Fans and Haters. That's M-O-R-A-N-O Radio Fans and Haters. All right, 800-848-9222. Let's begin with Vinny in Brooklyn. Vinny, what's your question?
How are you?
I'm good. That's a pretty easy question, Vinny.
No, my name's Tommy. I was hesitant.
Oh, Tommy. Okay. Well, according to Alex, who's in from Ali, your name's actually Vinny. So
I'll take it. Okay. Right. Vincenzo was nice. But here, I want to ask you something. If you see the same thing I'm seeing, you know, I'm looking at what's going on with Evergreen Corporation in China. They're posting a $300 billion debt. And I was amazed. You know, there's a large, ever-growing middle class in China. Have you seen the kind of homes that these people have put down $300,000 for? They're mostly high-rise apartments. Gorgeous. Have you happened to?
No, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Oh. And you know what it points out to me? No matter where you go in the world, everybody wants to have their own property, their own house. They want to live good. And this is what the Chinese government is fearful of. They've actually sent out notifications to towns to be alert because there may be riots and protests which turn into riots. Now, you look at, now, compare that.
Oh, are we done with the questioning portion, Tommy, or is there another question in here somewhere?
I wanted to know if you were aware of these three things, and I wanted to get your take on it.
Yeah.
Because you know how I'm not crazy about tens of thousands, or I think it's 1.5 million people have come in over the southern border in the 8 months of Biden's administration. The previous year, it was 456,000. So, you know, they may be shooting themselves in the foot, because I got to tell you something. A lot of these people that are coming in, Haitians, I lived in a Haitian community partially years back in Rockland County, and they're devout Christian Catholic people.
It's true.
That, goes hand in hand with capitalism.
All right. Well, Tommy, I'm glad I can answer your question. 800-848-9222. Gregory is in the Bronx. Gregory, what's your question?
Hi, Frank. I wanted to ask you how often you get hungover. Because you sound like that you enjoy your alcohol, and I wanted to know how you handle it.
You know, honestly, I'm going to answer the question as honestly as I can, but the answer to the question is never. I don't get hungover. I don't think – I think the last time I remember being hungover, I was a senior in high school. And I there have been days – so, yeah, I don't get hungover. Now, it could be a function of drinking so much, or it could be genetic. I've heard both both theories. Or it could be a function of drinking a lot of water throughout the day. And even when I'm drinking alcohol, I still tend to drink a lot of water. So, but I don't get hungover. I can have whether I'm having three drinks or seven, the next morning I'm as good as new. After maybe a 3-4 hour nap, I'm ready and raring to go. I don't get hungover.
That was my question, because you always seem good to go and you always seem fresh, but you always talk about how you like your drinks. So I'm wondering how you survive hangovers, but I guess you are not prone to them.
Yeah, no, I don't. And I've had friends that have been out with me at times, and they've had as much to drink as I have, and they're always complaining about a hangover the next day. I've never experienced it. Again, I think the closest thing I've experienced to it was maybe again when I was in the 12th grade, but not anything since then. But good question though, Gregory. 800-848-9222. Answering your questions on any subject. Paul is in Manhattan. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Frank.
Hi.
This is a topic that's come up before in the past.
Sure.
Could you run down the list of the celebrities or famous people that people say that you look like? Because I think I might have found the new one.
Well, you know, so a lot depends on what my weight is at any given time, because I fluctuate about 20 or 30 pounds given in any direction. So when I'm a little heavier, I tend to get Jason Alexander regularly. When I've been heavier, I've gotten John Belushi once or twice. And I'm trying to think who else I've gotten.
I think you've said this person before, but in case you haven't, I'll bring it up. I was watching a movie the other night. It's a movie you've probably seen. And I said, I looked at him and I went, wow, in this movie, this guy looks like Frank Moran.
Oh, who was it? Tell me.
Looks like him. Do you want me to tell you?
Tell me. I'm curious.
Albert Brooks in the movie Broadcast News.
Oh, really? No, actually, that's one that I haven't heard, but I can see
in
where you...
In that particular movie.
We do have a similar kind of hair. He's got... I have sort of an Italian afro. He's kind of got a Jufro. So I could actually see that. I've not been told that, but I could actually see that in that picture.
In that movie.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Yeah, I've heard worse. That's for sure, Paul. Thank you. 800-848-9222. Answering your questions on any subject. Eddie is in Toronto, our neighbor to the north. Hello, Eddie.
Hi, Frank. Good morning. My question is, I want to know, which kind of politician do you respect more? The ones who are always in the national spotlight and, you know, got big name recognition, always on the news? Or the ones who are quiet, no one ever heard of, and you just assume they're doing their job, because there's upside and downside to each one, you know.
Right. Well, there's both. I don't have a blanket rule about respecting lower profile politicians versus higher profile politicians. I respect politicians of any media profile. One, who are honest. Two, who are hardworking. Three, who have a governmental philosophy similar to mine. And four, you know, I mean, those are the big three. So it doesn't matter to me.
Really, my question is, what approach do you think is the right approach? To go out and put your name out there and be all loud and everywhere, or just to quietly do your job?
It's a good question, and I think it depends, and I'm not trying to evade your question. I think if you're going out there just for the sake of getting media attention, the best example that I can think of is Andrew Cuomo and maybe Chuck Schumer, I think that's a negative. However, if you're going out there and having a robust media profile because you're trying to bring attention to an issue or to alert the public about something, then I think that's very laudable. I remember when Dick Cody was governor of New Jersey, he would call all of the radio stations himself when there was a snowstorm and say, is there any information that you need? If you want me to go on air, I'm available. But if you don't, here's the information that I want to make sure you have. And I found that to be a real public service. So I think there's room for both, Eddie. 800-848-WABC, answering your questions on any subject. Let me say hello to Douglas in Brooklyn. Hello, Douglas.
Oh, hey, Frank. How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks.
Okay. I'd like to ask you about the demise or destruction of the New York City taxi limousine industry. And why was it necessary to destroy an entire industry?
Well, I don't think it was necessary. And I think, you know, clearly, if you look at the number of cabbies that have committed suicide over the course of the last 5 years, there's a whole lot more than just an economic realignment in the taxi industry. There's a lot of real world implications of this. I don't see any reason why you can't make the e-hail technology compatible with yellow cabs. Now, the people that were spending $800,000, $900,000, $1 million for a taxi medallion at the height of the taxi medallion bubble, I don't know that you'll ever be able to make those people whole. But as we're here now, I think there's definitely a way to incorporate technology that makes Uber and Lyft possible with taxis. Because one of my big problems with companies like Uber and Amazon, for instance, is it's not real capitalism. What it is predatory capitalism. And what these companies did, and my heart goes out not only to the yellow and green taxis, the street hails, but it goes to the car services that were so prevalent when I was growing up. Because what happened was Uber and Amazon were so willing to lose money in order to undercut the competition and put all of the competition out of business. Then, and as long as they had the pockets, the venture capital money to lose enough money every year to do that, then in the long term, it works. The competition goes out of business and then they can raise prices, which Uber has now done. It's very difficult to find a plain old regular car service. So I wish that we could do a better job allowing people to, and I've spoken with this on the air with John McDonough, who's actually a cabbie, and I wish we could have people use the Uber app, use the Lyft app, and have the option of also calling a yellow taxi as well. But I don't think it was necessary. I think it's incredibly unfortunate, in fact. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Pete in Staten Island, what's your question?
Frank, I got a question. With this election in November, is this the election that possibly the Republicans could get the majority in the Senate and the House, or is it going to be the following election? Would this be for November? Would it be installed in January?
No. Are you talking about the congressional elections?
Yeah.
No, that would be in November of 2022. So you have another year to go.
Another year. Thank you so much. And your ball playing was superb. There was a foul ball to third by the third base line. I picked up the ball, and I did exactly what Derek Jeter told President Bush not to do. I tried to throw it to you, and I bounced it.
Well, thank you, Pete. I appreciate you coming to the game last weekend. Appreciate it. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Nikki is in Manhattan. Hello, Nikki.
Good morning, Frank. Here's a question that's kind of out of left field.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, I heard a radio ad for a credit union, which was sponsoring a football broadcast for a very well-known elite university. And it touted, you know, the joys of banking with them. And at the end of the ad, instead of the usual FDIC statement, it said, by member's choice, this institution is not federally insured, which really surprised me. And, you know, of the obvious downside, I thought, what could be the upsides of this? Or is this just a show of lack of, you know, confidence in the government?
You know, that's a great question. And I'm assuming there are different rules for credit unions than there are for conventional banks. And I don't know why. I don't know why that's the case. The FDIC, as a general rule, only insures deposits in banks. Now, credit unions have their own insurance fund. It's run by the National Credit Union Association, Administration, National Credit Union Administration. I don't know if they will do the same thing and make you whole up to $100,000, but I think it's pretty similar. I think the only difference is the NCUA insures credit union deposits and the FDIC insures bank deposits. Other than that, I think they do pretty much the same thing, although I can't speak to the specifics of the amount of money.
Okay, thank you. It was just such an odd disclaimer.
Right. I think it makes sense. It would cause me to scratch my head, too. And I think it's probably because it was a credit union and not a bank. 800-848-WABC. Answering your question on any subject, at least doing my best to answer your questions on any subject. Let me say hello to Jean in Manhattan. Hello, Jean.
Yeah, hi, Frank. I know you've loved sports all your life, but when you were young, did you ever enjoy slow dancing or going to dances with the girls?
Well, you know, a slow dance I can deal with. As a general rule, I am not really much of a dancer, but a slow dance, I feel like I don't make as much of a fool of myself as I do if there's a little bit more freedom. So I never really went to dance clubs or anything like that, but a slow dance at a wedding or a party with somebody that you're close with, I think that's a lot of fun and a great way to be intimate with somebody.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Well, thank you, Gene. Hopefully we'll get to dance together one of these days. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. We'll continue answering your questions on any subject in just a moment. We have three open lines if you want to jump on board.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
The great Ringo Starr saying it don't come easy. Well, sometimes it don't come easy to get good questions, even when it's time for our weekly opportunity for you to ask questions on any subject. You have questions about radio, politics, the culture, you need advice on something, you have questions about my opinion on something, my personal biography or personal preferences, you're welcome to call in with any of that because it's time for
The Other Side of Midnight proudly presents Ask Frank.
Ask Frank Anything.
Ask Frank Anything.
Ask Frank Anything.
Ask Frank Anything.
Our phone number is 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Henry here in New York City. Hello, Henry.
Hi, Frank. I wanted to ask you about food container plastic recycling.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Do you think people would be willing to sort out food container waste to a much greater extent if the recycle number was larger and clearer?
What do you mean when you say the recycle number?
On the bottom of every kind of food container, there's a little triangle, and in the triangle, a number and it identifies as polystyrene.
Oh, I, you know what, Henry, you're teaching me something. I actually had no idea about that.
Yeah, there are seven numbers, like the milk jug is different than the PET soda bottle number, and that's different than a styrofoam.
Yeah, I didn't know that, but my answer to your question is yes. I think if it were more prominently displayed, then you would see more people recycling those containers.
And could the number also be printed on the label that's on the container and not just on the, you know, stamped into the container when it's manufactured?
I don't see why not, Henry. Makes sense to me. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Bill is in Huntington. Hello, Bill.
How you doing?
I'm well.
There was an episode of Seinfeld where Kramer, he drove a handsome cab, and he had these commissary-sized cans of beefaroni.
Right.
And he fed one to the horse.
Right.
And then the horse farted a lot, and they played the laugh track, okay? Now, in real life, I think that would kill the horse.
Well, so is that the question? Would it kill a horse?
Yeah.
The answer is I don't know. I remember the episode very well. But Seinfeld did occasionally use a laugh track, but most of those laughs were a live audience. I think because that particular scene looked like it was shot outdoors, it probably was a laugh track. But a lot of the laughter you hear was a live audience. Would beefaroni? Beefaroni is not a real product, but let's assume it's beefaroni or riceroni. Would that kill a horse? I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know who I would turn to answer that. I may turn to the internet on that one. So I don't know about that. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Mark is in Garden City. Hello, Mark.
How are you, Frank?
Good, thanks.
Frank, I just have a quick question. I wanted to ask you where the clip comes from at the beginning of the show where the person says, running a strange program, y'all.
You know, that question has come up before, and that is from the movie New Jack City, and that is Wesley Snipes' character.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's Wesley Snipes playing Nino Brown in New Jack City.
Interesting. Frank, I had another question. Weren't you the producer on a couple of pretty famous radio shows over the years?
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, I did. I was the producer of the Curtis and Kubi show. I was the producer of Curtis Lewis' solo show when he was syndicated and his local show. I was the producer for Mark Simone's Saturday Night Oldies show. I was the producer of John Gambling's radio show. I was the producer of Joe Piscopo's radio show. And then I would, at multiple stations that I've worked at, including this one, usually what a lot of program directors would do is because I was a bit more experienced than most producers. If somebody was just filling in temporarily, they would ask me to come in and work with that person if they were filling in for a day or a week. And in that capacity, I got to work with all sorts of interesting hosts, Geraldo, Larry Kudlow, Joe Scarborough, a whole lot of other Stephen A. Smith, a whole lot of other people. So yeah, but the main ones were Curtis and Kubi, Piscopo, and John Gambling.
Frank, how did you get started in the radio business?
Well, that's an interesting question. Did you ever see the movie The Shining?
I did.
So, you know, in The Shining, how Jack Nicholson is looking at those old black and white photos of people in tuxedos?
Yes.
Right. So he's looking at those photos, the whole picture, the whole film. And then at the end of the film, Jack Nicholson is in the photo, right? So you're not really sure why he's in the photo or how he ended up in the photo or when that happened. And I'll be honest, that is exactly the way that I feel with my journey in talk radio, because I was always, from the time that I was about seven or eight, I was always such a devoted talk radio listener, an obsessive talk radio listener, and I would call in to talk radio. I would write to all my favorite hosts. I would develop friendships with a lot of people that were on the radio, and I'm not really sure when I crossed that line between being a fan and working in talk radio. When I was 15 or 16, I started doing a public access television show on Staten Island. That kind of got me a little bit closer to this, and then I was on the radio in college. I interned at a radio station, and then I got on air occasionally, but it's not really a straight, direct line. There's a lot of zigging and zagging.
You know, it's funny that Rush Limbaugh said the same thing. By the time he was 8 years old, he wanted to be in radio. He was always very interested in radio.
Yeah, well, Rush, certainly, he did it better than anybody, that's for sure. Thank you for the question, though, Mark. 800-848-9222, 1-800-848-WABC. Susan is in Brooklyn. Hello, Susan.
Yeah, I also think you are really just a breath of fresh air. You're so well-rounded, and now after hearing your total background, yeah, you're super talented, super smart, super fun to listen to. I'm not supposed to say
thank you,
but I wanted to know, what are there any polls about the mayoral race with our hero Curtis against, you know,
right,
Adams.
Susan, that is the best question that I have heard in days. And it's a question that I ask every single day, because what we're seeing now is simply incredible. So Curtis and Eric Adams, they both won their primaries in June, 3 months ago, late June. And now we're in late September, and there has not been one public poll published, not by a media organization, not by a polling company, not by a college like Quinnipiac or Marist. So I find that very suspicious, because if you compare that to 2013 or 2017, it was a different ball game. So I don't know if Curtis's campaign has any internal polls. Since the primary, I've been a bit less involved in the day-to-day operations of the campaign. So I don't think they do. And because, you know, Curtis, until he got that $1.5 million a week or two ago, his resources were very limited. I don't think he wanted to spend $25,000-$30,000 on a poll, when I don't know that it would alter his strategy much to begin with. But there has not been a single poll that has been published publicly in this mayor's race. And I find that very suspicious, particularly when, Susan, if you look at the coverage that this race is getting on this radio station, in the New York Post, in the Daily News, in the Wall Street Journal, in the New York Times, in New Yorker, in New York Magazine, it all says the same thing about Eric Adams, the all but certain next mayor of New York City, the likely next mayor of New York City. They all describe Curtis the same way. Long shot challenger. Now, what are they basing that on? It looks to me that they're only basing it on the registration data. Curtis has more followers on Twitter than Eric Adams does. Curtis has more name recognition than Eric Adams does. It looks to me like the media and is trying to, whether it's intentional or unintentional, the media, by acting like this race is already a fait accompli and a done deal, it looks to me like they're trying to suppress turnout to some extent. That's a long way of answering your question, Susan. There has been no public poll, and if there's been any internal polls from either the Adams or the Sliwa campaign, I haven't been privy to it. I will tell you this. I thought Adams's reaction earlier in the week, flipping out about Curtis doing these Spanish language ads and playing the race card again, just as he did in the primary, was very illustrative of how worried the Adams campaign is about Curtis, particularly in the Hispanic community, being able to resonate. So there's no polls, but I think what you're going to see is the media is going to keep hammering this, Adams is going to win, Adams is going to win, Adams is going to win, and then after 5 months of Adams is going to win coverage, maybe a week before the election, maybe then there'll be a poll showing that that Adams is ahead. But I haven't seen a poll yet, Susan.
Okay, can he just please start talking about charter schools?
Yeah, well, look, it's a fine suggestion. I know he has
cats. I mean, we love cats. We love dogs.
Right.
It's fine. But we got to put the kids in education. There was just that article that was written by that student that went to charter schools and was then admitted into one of the elite high schools. Can't he just please, because a lot of voters don't know that it's the Democrats that are, and Black Lives Matter says, get rid of charter schools.
Right.
Well, get rid of, you know.
I think it's a fine idea, Susan. And look, I am not involved in the strategic direction of the campaign anymore, but Curtis has been very vocal on the charter school issue. If you go to his website, SlewaForNY.com, and look under issues, under education, it's one of the first things he says. Empower parents by expanding school choice and increasing the number of charter schools. He did a press conference on this on September 10th. He did a Facebook Live video on this on June 4th. He answered the question every time it came up in the debates as being favorable towards charter schools. So he's talking about charter schools. Whether the media chooses to cover him talking about charter schools is another matter. 800-848-9222. Mike is in New Jersey. Hello, Mike.
Good morning, Frank. Frank, if you could choose a profession other than broadcasting, what would your white-collar job be and your blue-collar job be?
Ah, that's a great question. So, you know, my answer to this question has changed over the years. So I always was very into the media. So I always had aspirations of being maybe a film producer or something like that. I really am intrigued by the whole filmmaking process, and I'd love to do that full time, even though, you know, I did produce the Netflix original documentary, Get Me Roger Stone, which people can watch. But, you know, I've never been able to pursue that as a full time vocation. I'd love to do something like that. You know, these days, being an expectant father and recognizing the costs that are involved with that, and seeing what is going on in New York City right now and New York State come a year or two from now in terms of public financing, right now New York is a gold mine for political consultants. And I think if I were to – and on top of that, almost every political consultant in New York – is really not worth their salt. They're all dumb, and they're all cashing six and in some cases seven-figure checks from taxpayer money, because the taxpayers in New York match these campaigns 8-1, I think I could make a good living as a political consultant in that area. As far as a blue-collar job goes, I am not the most handy person in the world. But I used to work in my Uncle Joe's shoe repair shop, and I really did like that. So I really could see myself doing that if I had to pick a blue-collar trade. I did like the shoe repair business.
Very good. And your one-year anniversary, was it Labor Day weekend you started last year?
It was September 29th.
29th. Coming up.
Yeah, that's right.
It'll be a great
next
year
week.
Of radio.
Thank you. Thank you,
thanks,
Mike.
Frank.
I appreciate
nice
it
weekend.
Very much. Thank you. If you have questions, 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. I will do my best to answer your questions on any subject. Al is in Tenafly, New Jersey. Hello, Al.
Hey, Frank, hi. I know you're quite a movie buff, and I really appreciate your comments over various shows on movies. I was a publicity intern at Universal's New York office working on a movie called Charade with Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant. And I'd like to get your take on Charade.
Oh, look, I like Charade, and it's not just Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant. Another one of my favorites is in that Walter Matthau. And I think it is a wonderful film, and I think it's a great story. I think it's a great kind of setting in Europe as it is. I think it's masterfully done. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful film. I think it's funny. I think it's got an element of romance in it, but it's also kind of a mystery. And there are not a lot of films that that touch all three of those cornerstones: mystery, romance, and comedy. And look, I'm a big Cary Grant fan, so I think it's terrific.
Dynamite, and George Kennedy was great in it too.
That's for sure. Thank you, Al. And That's right. I'd forgotten George Kennedy was in that from the Naked Gun movies. That's for sure. It's funny about Cary Grant. So Mark Simone, when he and I were, you know, we're pretty good friends, we used to go out pretty regularly. And Mark, the thing that's so great about him is that you could throw any celebrity at him in the world, and Mark will have a story about that celebrity. So I'll never forget one Saturday night, Mark and I are out with Jay Diamond. The three of us go out on the town one night, and we had such a good time. It was a real treat being around those three guys, those two guys. And this one particular night, Jay and I are asking Mark all sorts of stories about Frank Sinatra, and Jay is asking questions to Mark about Cary Grant. And Mark begins describing a moment where he was present, where Cary Grant is, I don't know if he was meeting Sinatra for the first time, probably not. This is, you know, 14 or 15 years ago. Actually, it was 16 years ago that this interaction occurred. So he's describing an interaction between Sinatra and Cary Grant. And who knows if it's true? You know, with Mark's stories, you really never know if they're true. But this one was simple enough that I tend to think it is true. And Cary Grant is being introduced to some of Frank Sinatra's gangster friends. And Sinatra introduces Cary Grant to a guy that's with him by the name of Joey Tomatoes. And Sinatra says to Cary Grant, "Hey, Cary, say hello to Joey Tomatoes." And Cary Grant says, "Ah, Mr. Tomatoes, how do you do?" And I always thought that was just so funny, because you could picture Cary Grant saying it, and you could picture Frank Sinatra's reaction when he does. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Gino in Brooklyn. Hello, Gino.
Hello, sir. It's obvious I've been listening to you for a long time, and you work like an animal. You've put the grind in. You deserve everything you've gotten.
Oh, thanks, Gino.
I often wonder, though, if there was another radio market to work in, where would you choose to go? I mean, so many people work their way to New York. You were so fortunate to grind your way within the tops of the industry. But what market would you want to work in outside of New York?
Well, so it's a good question, and I'm going to do my best to answer it. But my question for you about your question is, in your scenario, would I also be living in that market full time, or would I be residing in New York and then doing a show somewhere else?
See, that's a good bounce back, because yes, the industry has changed where you can now do, obviously we hear that across the band, you could host shows from anywhere. I would think that if you actually had to up and leave with your family to another market for another opportunity, perhaps maybe a morning show somewhere, or you know, somewhere else where your opportunities would be better, where you'd have to up and leave.
Well, all right. Well,
no station, but what market would you mean?
Okay. Well, so if I was banished from New York radio, if I was publicly disgraced because I went on the air drunk and I insulted all of my colleagues and all the advertisers and said a bunch of racist things and you know, did all sorts of bizarre things that got me publicly banned, and I had to leave New York radio, I think the market that I would go to if I had to live there, because it's a market that I feel like I know so well, I would do Atlantic City. I would do the Atlantic City radio market. There's two very good talk stations out there, and we're heard in Atlantic City, but there's two very local talk stations out there. I could easily see myself doing a show on one of those stations. Thank you, Gino. I hope that never happens. I hope I'm never banished from New York radio. 800-848-WABC, answering your questions about any subject. Anthony is in Westchester. Hello, Anthony.
Hi, Frank. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, sure.
Here's my question. I'm a gay policeman, okay? As you know, the parade organizers for Gay Pride in 2021 banned, for the very first time, they set a precedence. They banned police from marching in the parade in their uniform. And not just the New York City agency, but agencies across the United States followed suit. Seattle PD, San Francisco PD, Milwaukee PD, Atlanta PD. Here's my question. What is your position, and how do you feel about the fact that these agencies banned gay policemen from marching in the parade?
I think it's outrageous. I think it's absolutely outrageous. I think the fact that they're enjoying police protections to put these parades on, the fact that so many police officers have been so responsive to so many gay people that have been victims of hate crimes over the years, for their reaction to be to prohibit police officers from marching in uniform, I think it's pure bigotry, quite honestly. I think it's absolutely outrageous.
Thank you for your support. The rationale that was given is the message that we would send to participants of the parade. It would send the wrong message because, as you know, the current climate towards law enforcement, there is a great deal of distrust among us. And the parade organizers had said they didn't even want police protection. They wanted us to maintain a two-block distance from the perimeter and that they would hire private security. Here's my other question. When a gay person finds himself in need of law enforcement protection,
right,
who's the first they're going to call?
Oh, no, Anthony, you're exactly right. And it's a rhetorical question that doesn't require an answer. It's outrageous.
Yeah.
It's completely outrageous what the Pride Parade did. And I hope it's something that they change course on in short order. All right, 800-848-9222.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Family Stone, Everybody is a Star. This is The Other Side of Midnight, answering your questions on any subject. Let me say hello to Billy in Rockland County. Hello, Billy.
Hey, Frank, how you doing?
Good.
You know, I really appreciate you being live on every night.
Oh, thank you.
Whatever night you're on. Crazy question. If you could own any nightclub throughout New York City history, what would it be?
Oh, so not necessarily one that's open now, but anyone ever.
Yeah.
Well, I think it would have to be the Copa.
The Copa in the Rat Pack days?
Yeah, I think so. I think that would be kind of my cup of tea. I think so.
I had another question for you. You mentioned the guy on the dial down below. What's the secret to being friendly with all these celebrities?
I don't know, honestly. I mean, he's been in radio a long time, and he was in music radio for a long time since he was, I think, 16 or 17. So he got to meet a lot of interesting people that way. Mark also always had money. He always had a lot of money. And when you always have a lot of money, you can kind of hang out in that kind of a crowd. I think that's part of it. Also, because Mark is so entertaining as a storyteller and a dinner companion, he gets invited to a lot of these dinners, and that leads to invitations to more dinners. And because he is one of the most sought-after MCs in New York, he gets to MC a lot of events that involve a lot of celebrities. And then for years, not so much anymore, for years he was involved with the Friars Club, when there were a lot of high-profile people in the Friars Club. But so I think that's the best I can do in terms of answering that one.
All right. Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you, Billy. Appreciate it. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Mike is in Manhattan. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Frank. You've gone to see pro wrestling in person, haven't you?
Yes, many times.
I wanted to ask you, now, when you're in the crowd, do you think that the crowd actually understands that they're seeing a show, or are there people there that really buy into it?
No, I don't think in this day and age that there's anybody that thinks pro wrestling is on the level. I think just about everybody knows that the outcome is predetermined.
Right. So like when they go, it's like going to see a Broadway show almost, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Again, I think there's a lot of different types of crowds. Now, I've seen wrestling in a lot of different scenarios. Now, my favorite type of venue to see wrestling in is a high school or church gymnasium that can fit less than 1,000 seats in it. A small independent show, because there's a lot of excitement. You're up there close with the wrestlers. You can shout at them. They can hear you. You can go back and forth with them. Then that kind of an environment is very different than a wrestling match at some place like Madison Square Garden or Nassau Coliseum, which is just so large and so big that you get the sense that any cheer you do is sort of a drop in the bucket. Then I was also, years ago when WCW was doing their tapings in Orlando, Florida, I went to a taping, and what they would do is they would do the tapings of their Saturday night show, which was WCW Saturday Night. I was in Disney, I think it was with my mother, and they would give tickets away to people in the theme park. Now, the people in the theme park didn't know anything about wrestling or any of the characters, so they had to be so heavily coached once they got into the mini arena that they built for TV that it came across as very fake. They had to be kind of cajoled with the lures of free T-shirts and things like that. So there's all sorts of different wrestling audiences. Mine is my favorite type is a small gymnasium independent show filled with enthusiastic wrestling fans.
Now, with the independent shows, do you get the big names or do you get the lower card?
Well, you get both, right? It depends on what independent shows you go to. But since most of the wrestlers that I liked are no longer active in the main federations, if you want to see kind of I like older wrestlers, those are the guys that you generally see on the independent circuit now, the guys that are retired and probably a little bit past their prime. So that's it's been years since I've been. But yeah, you see guys that used to be big years ago.
Right, right. I see what you mean. I know. Did you ever go to a WrestleMania event?
No, I never went to a WrestleMania. I went to SummerSlam. I went to SummerSlam 1991, which had some great matches. Bret Hart versus Mr. Perfect, one of the best matches that I've ever seen for the Intercontinental Championship. That was 30 years ago. Last month, and that was a lot of fun. But I've never been to a WrestleMania.
Oh. But they used to have some strange names, Halloween Havoc and all that kind of
stuff. Yeah. No, well, again, I watched most of them on television, but never been to – the only pay-per-view that I was ever at in person was a SummerSlam 30 years ago. Mike, thanks for the call. I'll be honest, though, not just with wrestling, with baseball, with football. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting old. I find I enjoy going to live sporting events so much less than I used to. I mean, you talk about the hassle that goes into going to a live sporting event, with the exception of minor league baseball. I still really enjoy minor league baseball. But you have to travel out there, either by train or you drive. If you drive, there's traffic. Then you have to pay to park. Costs a fortune to get a beer and a knish. It's I don't know. I've really become much more disposed to watching sports, including pro wrestling, on television rather than going to the event in person. 800-848-9222. Steve is in Stamford. Hello, Steve.
Yeah, hey, Frank. Great show, by the way.
Thank
you're
you.
Particularly gifted.
Thank you.
I want to ask you a question, though. In the business, they call it block programming, things like that. The doctor talks about cancer all weekend. WOR, particularly, and now he's buying time here and there a little bit on ABC et cetera. And why do program directors go to that? Is it that they get so much money from it, or they don't have to pay a talent?
Well, I think it's both, right? And if you notice on our station, we do it less than just about anybody, right?
Much less. But, and I'm sure that the audience appreciates it.
And I think that's one of the reasons that we've seen such an uptick in the ratings over the course of the last 6 months, is we've done away with a lot of that block programming, whereas the other stations haven't.
Remarkably better, yep.
But so, Steve, the answer to your question is both. And it's self-defeating. And a big part of the problem that talk radio has these days is because they've so chased the audience away with that block programming, because the general managers of these radio stations, again, not ours, but other stations that I've worked for over the years, and in the years past this station under different ownership, they get so addicted to that easy infomercial money. Oh, you mean they're going to pay us $3,000? And all we have to do is press play on a recording. We don't have to hire a call screener or a producer or an engineer that stays awake. They're going to pay us $3,000 for this? Great, we'll take it. And it becomes almost like crack. It becomes addictive. And the more of that block programming they put on, the more the audience gets chased away. And the more the audience gets chased away, the less they can charge for ad rates during the actual radio shows. And the more they become dependent on that block programming. It becomes sort of a self-defeating strategy. Hey, Space Force! We're going to talk about it next with Dr. Michael Sala. This is a conversation you won't want to miss. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Hello, everyone. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. So all week, the buzz all about the Space Force, well, actually, there's been quite a bit of buzz about the Space Force, but so much of it has had to do with the uniforms, with a number of people saying the uniforms are similar to those that were on the television show Battlestar Galactica, and others saying that it was similar to the uniforms that were on Star Trek. Now, the first person that I thought of when I saw these news reports was the guest who has been kind enough to join us for the hour. And I have to warn you, he has been a guest that I've gotten a lot of complaints about in the past. What kind of complaints, you ask? Well, generally, after our interviews are done, I am deluged with people calling, texting and emailing the complaint, how could you not have him on for longer? Well, we are very, very lucky to have on a real expert and a real authority, and a man who, whether you accept his conclusions or not, is a fascinating individual. I am very pleased to welcome Dr. Michael Sala. He's the author of a whole bunch of books on the secret space program. He's also a pioneer in the field of exopolitics and a former professor in political science. Kind enough to join us live from Hawaii. Aloha, Dr. Sala.
Aloha. Thanks for having me on the show, Frank.
It's always my pleasure. You know how much I enjoy talking with you. If people are unfamiliar with your background, sir, can you briefly explain what exopolitics is? I think it's probably a term that many folks may be unfamiliar with.
Sure. Put it simply, it's the political science of extraterrestrial life. It's looking at what it means in terms of the policy implications to have extraterrestrials visiting us or interacting with us in some way.
All right. Well, that sounds simple enough. Space Force got a lot of attention when President Trump first launched it because of the similarity to the emblem on Star Trek. This week, it turns out the uniforms are also pretty similar to the Star Trek universe. You have written a book called Space Force, Our Star Trek Future. It's available on Amazon and wherever books are available online. Something tells me, Dr. Sala, you're going to tell us this isn't simply a coincidence that the emblem and the uniform looks exactly like that on Star Trek.
Not at all. It is definitely not a coincidence. The Space Force actually is following recommendations of a report issued in 2019. It was convened by the predecessor of Space Force, which was Air Force Space Command, and they convened over 60 experts at a workshop in March of 2019, and they outlined eight possible futures for humanity's expansion into space. And the one that they adopted as the optimal forward strategy for Air Force Space Command, which today is Space Force, was actually a Star Trek future. So that was in 2019. That is actually what Space Force is aiming for. It is part of this long-term vision, and they set the date of 2060, that in the next 40 years, humanity will arrive at this Star Trek future.
That might take some people by surprise. Why would an agency of the U.S. government, specifically a branch of the U.S. military, mimic their agenda, their look, their emblem on a fictional TV show?
Well, that takes us into the deeper question of exactly how did Star Trek, the TV show, take off? And one of the things that I discussed in the book is that Gene Roddenberry was actually on the set, on the television set of the creator of The Outer Limits, and his name was Leslie Stevens. And Leslie Stevens was the son of a Navy vice admiral that was heading psychological operations for the U.S. Navy, where they would use the entertainment industry for soft disclosure, that they would condition the public for a time when they would reveal the truth about the Navy's secret space program, about the existence of extraterrestrial life. And Star Trek was, from the very beginning, a soft disclosure initiative promoted by the U.S. Navy for this long-term psychological conditioning to prepare humanity for a future where we would be following a path very similar to what was outlined in Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek show.
So what you're saying is that Star Trek was not just a clever work of fiction, but Admiral Stevens actually, either directly or through the intermediary of Leslie Stevens, gave information about what the United States government knew about extraterrestrials in space, gave it to Gene Roddenberry, and then Roddenberry produced a television show with those same concepts in order to sort of prepare the public for that eventuality one day.
Absolutely. That is what has happened. And that is actually part of the official record in terms of people who sat in during the Outer Limits series, which was highly successful. It ran from 1963 to 1965. And they observed that during the second season, Gene Roddenberry came in and actually sat in on many of the shows, really getting ideas from the creator, Leslie Stevens IV, that is the son of the Vice Admiral, for his own sci-fi series. And that was because Leslie Stevens IV was actually part of this Navy psychological warfare program to really use the entertainment industry to prepare the public. And it's very interesting, at the very beginning, you mentioned two shows where the uniforms are very similar. You mentioned Star Trek, and you also mentioned Battlestar Galactica. Well, it turns out that Leslie Stevens IV also wrote the pilot episode for Battlestar Galactica.
Wow.
The creator of Battlestar Galactica, Glenn Larson, actually, he was given the ideas by Gene Roddenberry.
That is remarkable. And I thought I knew both shows pretty well. I didn't know Leslie Stevens wrote that that first episode. Now, this is going to be shocking to a lot of people, maybe even people that are fans of Star Trek or Battlestar Galactica. What is, just so folks know, and I do hope they'll get the book, Space Force, Our Star Trek Future by Dr. Michael Sala, available on Amazon. What is your source for this? How do you know that Gene Roddenberry was the recipient of this information from Admiral Stevens?
Well, one of my sources was the late William Tompkins, who worked for the U.S. Navy during the Second World War and also after the Second World War when he was stationed at Douglas Aircraft Company. He was actually part of a think tank at Douglas Aircraft called Advanced Design, and they were helping the Navy build a secret space program. And Tompkins said that Leslie Stevens, both the admiral and his son, were familiar with the Navy's plan for a secret space program, and that they were working with extraterrestrials, human-looking extraterrestrials, that actually were infiltrated into the Douglas Aircraft Company. He described three of them, and that they were helping Douglas engineers and scientists come up with designs and ideas for a future fleet of spacecraft. And this was happening not only at Douglas, but other aerospace companies in the 1960s. And William Tompkins said that, and I asked him about this, he said, yes, absolutely. Admiral Stevens and his son were very familiar with this, and that they were helping get this idea out into the general public through shows like Star Trek, later Battlestar Galactica, and other shows as well, such as the one that is the most famous for the kind of boomer generation is The Day the Earth Stood Still. Mm. And that came out in 1951. Now, the person who headed the Navy psychological operations in 1951 was no other than Admiral Leslie Stevens. So he was the one that kind of started the ball rolling in getting the world or the American public to start opening up to the idea of a wider galactic society out there observing us and wanting to make sure that we follow a peaceful path of development rather than going down the path of nuclear weapons and so forth, which are all part of the Day the Earth Stood Still. So there's a continuity in those shows between The Day the Earth Stood Still, the Star Trek series, Battlestar Galactica, and you have Leslie Stevens, either the admiral or his son, being involved in all of them.
Wow. It's interesting because you're right. A lot of the science fiction films and television programs, or even fiction of the literature of the 40s and 50s, had a very different feel to it. It was a lot of, oh, aliens are going to take over the world. We have to try and stop them. They're going to kill us all. And then with all the shows that you mentioned, there was a very different tone with how humans relate to extraterrestrial life. And apparently that's no accident.
That is exactly right, that this has been part of a long-term plan by the Navy to prepare the American public and the world public for a day where the truth will be revealed.
And you think the timeline is 2060?
Well, that is what the workshop stipulated as the timeline, that in the next 40 years, you have this Star Trek future unfolding. But I don't think we have to wait 40 years at all. I think we are truly at the verge of a lot of these things happening over the next few years. That I think right now, what is happening is that we're kind of like going through a planetary birthing process, if you like, that people's at the moment, people are in a lot of pain, that the world that they knew, that they grew up with, is disappearing. It's not there any longer. And what's going to happen at the end of all of this, say, whether it's 6 months, whether it's 2 years, at some point we're going to come out of this. And then people will be ready for something new. And I think that's when the Navy and the Space Force are going to unleash some pretty amazing things to us. And I think high amongst that list of revelations will be that the Navy has been working with these positive extraterrestrials for over 60 years now, and that this kind of idea of the United Federation of Planets in the Star Trek series, that something similar does exist already, and we are part of it.
Well, that is wild. I want to ask you a little bit about that when we continue. If people have questions for Dr. Michael Sala, you can give us a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Serious questions only, please. And we're going to continue with Dr. Michael Sala in just a minute.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
In my direction, I caught it in my hands today. I finally made a tricky French connection. You winked and gave me your okay. I'll take you on a trip beside the ocean and drop the top of Chesapeake Bay. Ain't nothing like the sky to dose a potion. The moon will send you on.
Moonlight feels right. Well, a lot of people have been looking up at the moon this week because of the harvest moon and all the attention that that's been getting. And it has a lot of people asking some questions about space. We've been talking with Dr. Michael Sala, who is a former professor of political science and author of a series of books dealing with America's secret space program. And what he's said in this book, Space Force, Our Star Trek Future, and on the radio with us today, is that Star Trek is not just some sort of imaginary fictional television show of what life was like or would be like in the 23rd century. Rather, Star Trek was a way for the government to prepare the public consciousness for what was coming. In terms of alien contact, in terms of friendly aliens, adversarial aliens, and it's pretty groundbreaking. And Dr. Michael Sala has been kind enough to share some of the information that he's been researching for literally years on this subject, including the fact that Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, was putting this stuff out there that the government knew was true through this person, Admiral Stevens, who was in charge of this for the Navy. Gene Roddenberry in 1986 talked about how ahead of the game Star Trek was and how he wished sometimes how the rest of the culture would follow Star Trek's lead.
Mass communications is our language today between one another, and we can't say, well, let's not really talk about anything serious on television. That is a criminal statement and a criminal intention. In my opinion, the audience is way ahead of our government leaders. I think the government leaders should catch up with the audience, and then we'd have 21st century dreams right now.
Dr. Sala, I'm curious, had Gene Roddenberry said anything else while he was alive about essentially giving a hint that what you're saying was true?
No, he didn't say anything suggesting that he got these ideas from any official source at all. I think that was part of the deal in terms of that he would not disclose that he was an asset of the Navy, that the Navy had fed him these ideas or encouraged him to put out a series similar to what the Navy was already working on in real life, because the Navy had to maintain plausible deniability. Because, I mean, we're talking about a real space program that the Navy had set up in the 1950s. So this was something that was this was way beyond top secret. This was highly compartmentalized. Even people at the Air Force and the CIA weren't aware of the Navy's secret space program. Only very, very few were aware of this. So the Navy, in terms of maintaining operational security, reached an agreement with Roddenberry where these ideas would essentially be credited just to him. And which is very interesting, because in the movie industry, typically people are very jealous,
right,
or very proprietary about their names. But of course, Leslie Stevens IV, the creator of The Outer Limits, I mean, he didn't do anything in terms of claiming any credit for helping Roddenberry come up with the idea of Star Trek. He didn't claim any credit for helping Glenn Larson come up with Battlestar Galactica. And that's very typical of a Navy intelligence operative.
Talking with Dr. Michael Sala, we're going to take as many of your questions as we can. 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Rich is in Yonkers. Rich, what's your question for Dr. Sala?
Yeah, listen, I really have two. My dad worked on the Philadelphia experiment where they made the ship disappear in the early 1940s. And it actually cost my brother, my older brother, his life. Maybe it damaged his genes. But anyway, I want to ask two questions. First of all, how do we know that these aliens are not working with Russia or China, first of all? And secondly, what do they look like? Where did they come from? What did they eat? Where did they sleep? How did they keep them confidential?
Dr. Sala, I'll let you do your best in answering both of those.
Sure. Well, in terms of what do these extraterrestrials look like, I mean, there are many different types, but the ones that are involved in this kind of Star Trek future are human-looking. They look very much like us, and they have been working with the U.S. Navy behind the scenes since the 1950s. Now, as far as other countries are involved, one of the policies of the extraterrestrials has been to share the information with the major powers at the time. So while these extraterrestrials approached the U.S. Navy in the 1950s and began working with them, they also did the same thing with the Soviet Union. In fact, the very same admiral, Leslie Stevens, that was in charge of psychological operations for the day the Earth stood still, he was also the U.S. Navy's naval attaché to the Soviet embassy in Moscow, or to the U.S. embassy in Moscow from 1947 up until 1950. And he was there to help the Soviet Union set up their own secret space program, because the Soviets and the Americans were working together as far as collaborating with these extraterrestrials. But on the other hand, they made it look like that they were working against each other in the Cold War. So it was really a very clever way of conducting a Cold War, where you would get huge amounts of funding to sink into this nuclear arms race. But at the same time, you would also siphon off a lot of that money so that you would collaborate in secret space programs and try and work with these extraterrestrials. And so that was happening behind the scenes, and Leslie Stevens was involved.
You mentioned, so it seems pretty clear that the government knew what was going on in terms of extraterrestrial contact going back 50 or 60 years. That would seem to suggest that the DNI report that was released over the summer, supposedly with the Director of National Intelligence and the Pentagon disclosing to Congress and the public what they knew about these UAPs, it would seem to suggest that what they put out was not exactly accurate. Is that right?
Yeah, very far from being accurate. I mean, that report really tried to make out as though The government had no idea what these objects are, UAPs are. And, you know, and it's always important to point out that the people writing these reports, I mean, they may be absolutely truthful, that as far as they know, these UAPs do not belong to the U.S. government because they haven't received clearance for that. They haven't been read into those programs. But people who have been read into those programs, they know absolutely that the U.S. government, different branches of the government, the Air Force has its own space program, the Navy has its own space program, and the CIA also has its own space program that it's been running with the National Reconnaissance Office for several decades now. So there are multiple secret space programs in the U.S., and then you have corporations that develop the prototype anti-gravity vehicles. So, yes, those people who have been read in, they know some of the stuff that is being seen that are in these reports, these UAPs, that they belong to us. But the people writing reports, I mean, they don't have that kind of clearance. So as far as they know, these are genuine unknowns and that they might be security threats if China or Russia is behind them.
Talk with Dr. Michael Sala. If you want to ask a question, you could do so 1-800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Getting back to the Space Force, news came out in the last day or so that the Chief of Space Operations, General John Raymond, unveiled what's being referred to as the Guardian Ideal document at the Air Force Association's Airspace and Cyber Conference. And apparently in this new document, Space Force is calling for a very different approach to recruiting and retaining skilled personnel, arguing that service members and civilian workers should have more flexibility to make career choices than under the traditional military personnel system. Is there anything that we can divine from this, Dr. Sala?
Yeah, there's a few things we can kind of like deduce from that document. That is that Space Force is really trying to recruit a lot of experts from the civilian sector. I mean, they have a desperate need of high-quality scientists, engineers, people with expertise relevant to space. They need people who have this kind of expertise, and they have to draw them away from the civilian sector. And in order to do that, you need to be flexible in terms of allowing people to continue to develop their skill sets. You try and come up with some kind of compensation system so that they receive similar compensation to private industry. Because, I mean, right now, I mean, space has become very hot in terms of, like, you have many companies now, like Blue Origin, like SpaceX, like Virgin Galactic, and you know, Bigelow Aerospace. So there's a lot of civilian companies now that are looking for the same people, people with expertise in space. And so that means that Space Force is competing with these civilian space programs, which is very different to, like, the other military services. Like, you know, the Navy, there's no real competitor to the Navy, nor is there a competitor to the Air Force or to the Army. But Space Force does have competitors because SpaceX, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, all of these companies are doing similar things in wanting to go deep into space. And, you know, obviously they want to do things in space in terms of the commercial side of things. But the people that are going to allow them to get out into space are the same kind of people or experts that Space Force needs to be able to establish supremacy in space.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned, you know, in the Star Trek universe, for people that aren't familiar with the series and the films, the Earth is part of an intergalactic, basically an intergalactic UN that they refer to as the United Federation of Planets, or just the Federation when they're, you know, being short. You indicated earlier that you believe our planet is already part of some sort of a galactic Federation. What do we know at this point, and how do we know it?
Well, we know it from the fact that these human-looking extraterrestrials began working with the U.S. Navy in the 1950s, and a lot of this information came from this one insider, William Tompkins, who has absolutely great credentials. I mean, he has documentation showing that he worked at Douglas Aircraft, that he worked at NASA, that he worked for the U.S. Navy. So he's got a lot of documentation, which I described in one of my books called The U.S. Navy's Secret Space Program. And he talked about this collaboration between the Navy and this alliance of extraterrestrials, and which pretty much equates to this United Federation of Planets. He didn't use those terms exactly, but he did to use the term that there was an alliance of these human-looking worlds and that they were working with the Navy. And that matches with what we know about the Star Trek series in terms of this humanity being part of this wider federation of planets. And there have been people that have been talking about a federation of planets going back to the 1950s. I mean, Daniel Fry, one of the old-time UFO contactees, I mean, he began in 1952 talking about a galactic federation. And so we can go back to the early 50s, and there were people already talking about this galactic federation interacting with humanity. So I think there's a lot of evidence in terms of these testimonies of all of these old-timers from the 1950s that said, yeah, absolutely, the Navy and our planet are working with or know about this this galactic federation.
We spent a lot of time talking about Star Trek. You mentioned the other series that was likely inspired by information coming from high-level government operatives was Battlestar Galactica. If people aren't familiar with that series, essentially the premise of that series is there's this tribe of humans, and their planets are destroyed, and they have to search for a mythological planet that is supposedly also contains humans called Earth. Do you think that is Admiral Mills's way of preparing humans for the fact that there are indeed people of our species on other planets?
Well, it was definitely a soft disclosure, and there were many elements in there that are worth kind of like digging into. You know, one is the idea of, you know, galactic wars, that also, you know, the idea of galactic refugees coming to Earth. But another idea that I think was very important was the notion that artificial intelligence is very, very dangerous, that artificial intelligence can evolve to the point where it can turn on its creators and hunt after them. And that we saw in the series Battlestar Galactica, which what was very interesting about Battlestar Galactica, the series, was that in 2010, the United Nations actually invited the cast and crew of the reboot of the series to the
That's
United
right.
Nations.
That's right. I'd forgotten that. You're right.
And that's the only television show that has ever been acknowledged by the United Nations as actually making a contribution to international politics. But it was more than that. It was really showing a way in how humanity could deal with this future threat involving non-organic or synthetic life forms. So that, you know, one of the galactic conflicts is organic versus synthetic life forms, or AI. And that is something that many insiders say actually is a very, very big problem out in the galaxy. And, of course, in the Star Trek series, you know, you have the Borg. So the same idea that the artificial intelligence can be very dangerous.
Yeah, and that is certainly a lesson that both of those series teach, 100%. In terms of where we're headed with Space Force, some people have suggested that maybe China or other countries on this earth might look to weaponize space and be hostile to the United States through space, and maybe that's what Space Force is all about. In addition to everything that you've described, do you think that's a realistic goal of Space Force? Is a space, a weaponized Chinese space entity, something that we need to be worried about, in your view?
Yes, there is a big worry about China's secret space program because China's economy has become so big. It's on the verge of overtaking the U.S. economy in real terms. And so it's spending more and more of its money on military development, and it's focusing on space. And so, you know, right now, I mentioned that the Navy has a secret space program, the Air Force has a secret space program, the NRO and the CIA have secret space programs, but they're all relatively small. The Navy is actually is bigger than the other ones. But the thing is, what China is doing is it's pouring vast resources into space. And the U.S. government, and this is under the Trump administration, understood this, that if drastic action wasn't taken soon, that China, because of its vast economy and its successful espionage and intellectual theft programs, it would eventually catch up and surpass everything that the U.S. has been developing in space. So that's why Space Force has been set up and why Space Force is behind the creation of this multinational space alliance, why the Artemis Accords were set up to encourage the U.S. to collaborate with all of its major allies in space, because they know if the U.S. can't do it on its own anymore, that China has become so big and the U.S. needs its allies. It needs Britain, it needs France, it needs Germany, it needs Canada or Australia, India, Japan. It needs all these countries to collaborate with it to make sure that they stay well ahead of everything China is doing in space, because China is hell-bent on establishing space dominance by the 2030s.
We saw the first all-civilian space flight with through SpaceX, Elon Musk's entity, and I'm curious what your take on that whole situation is. SpaceX first private crewed flight, which seems to be successful. Four people go up to space. They stayed up there a day or two, and they came back. A lot of people talked about the significance of that as ushering in a new age of space tourism. Is that how you see it, or is there more to it that we're not seeing?
Definitely there's more to it. I mean, this is a part of the Star Trek future that Space Force is working towards. In that workshop I mentioned that was held by Air Force Space Command back in 2019, they identified three critical areas that were essential to establishing a Star Trek future. One was the civil society. You need to have a lot of people out in space. One was the commercial. You needed to have companies very active in space, building very large ships, getting thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people to the moon, to Mars, to the asteroid belt, and so forth. And then you needed to have the leadership. You needed to have the military and the political leadership, which is what the U.S. is doing through Space Force, through U.S. Space Command, through the Artemis Accords. So what SpaceX is doing, what Blue Origin is doing, all of that is part of this Star Trek future, because all of those things need to flourish in order to introduce this Star Trek future, because we need to get literally hundreds of thousands of people out into space to do the exploration, to do the mining, to do the tourism, to do the colonization.
Well, Elon Musk, whose company that is, SpaceX, he tweeted the other day, there are UFOs, and then he deleted that tweet. Now, Elon Musk is known for busting chops on Twitter, and, you know, who knows what his actual rationale was there. But do you believe that Elon Musk and maybe even the other space billionaires, Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos, do you believe that they're in on what's happening, knowing about extraterrestrial civilizations that our planet is regularly in contact with? And is there anything else that we can deduce from Elon Musk tweeting that and then suddenly deleting that tweet?
Yes, I think that was a very revealing tweet by Elon Musk. I think he put out a little bit more than he was supposed to, and I think someone asked him to take that back, or I think he has signed some non-disclosure agreement concerning some recent information that he's been party to. And I think the same thing with Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos. Yeah, there's some information which is kind of like really fascinating that I've been following and researching, and so far it checks out. And that is that in July of this year, that there were a set of meetings held above the atmosphere of Jupiter, where this Galactic Federation had U.S. Space Command and the space leadership of 14 countries represented to reach these agreements on how the solar system is to be colonized by humanity. And I think this is part of the reason why Musk and those others recently were given information that this is all real, that extraterrestrial life is real, and that there's a federation out there, and that we have begun working with it, and that this is something that will eventually be revealed to the rest of humanity.
Wow, that is pretty groundbreaking. We're going to continue with Dr. Michael Sala in just a minute. 800-848-WABC. If you have questions, it's 800-848-9222.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Get your falling star and put it in your pocket. Never let it fade away. Get your falling star and put it in your pocket. Save it for a rainy day. For love may come and tap you on the shoulder some starless night. Just in case you feel you want to hold her, you'll have a pocket full of starlight. Catch your falling star.
The great Perry Como. We are talking with Dr. Michael Sala. You can check out his work and several of his books by going to, you know, to Amazon. And there's just a whole world opens up on there. He is a former professor of political science. He is an expert in the field of exopolitics. If you go to the website exopolitics.org, there's a series of articles that are just fascinating. That's exopolitics.org. He's been kind enough to join us for the hour. 800-848-9222. Richard is in Parsippany, New Jersey. Hello, Richard. You're on with Dr. Sala.
Yeah, hi, Frank. I'm here. Okay, let me give a slightly different perspective on this in 3 points. Firstly, you know, any secret activity in our government outside the view of the people, without the permission of the people, has to be considered to be organized crime. Number two, you know, the business of the fantasies and stories of spaceships and going into space goes back to the 1920s and even before, with Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon, and all that. Number three, most importantly, Star Trek. Star Trek was pitched to CBS as Cowboys and Indians in Space.
Right, NBC, Wagon Train to the Stars.
What's that?
Right, NBC, Wagon Train to the Stars was the was the expression. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, it was pitched out like that, and it was about, you know, just violence and fighting. In Westerns, everybody carried a gun. In Star Trek, everybody carried a gun. And it was battle to battle, and they had the women in the short dresses. In the Westerns, they had the women in the saloons. So there was really no great important purpose to Star Trek. It was just a show that they would sell because it was cowboys and Indians.
Well,
in space.
Richard, the reason, and I'll let Dr. Sala speak, but the reason I disagree with your premise that it was just a show is if you look at how much of the technology of Star Trek then became reality. You had the communicators on the original series, which became flip phones. You have the way they communicate through view screens, which became Zoom and Skype. You had the iPad. Ads in Star Trek The Next Generation 30 years before there were iPads. Now, I, prior to hearing what Dr. Sala was saying, thought that that was because Star Trek inspired creativity among earthly innovators. But Dr. Sala is saying maybe they knew that technology and other things was coming and that the television show put it out there. But any comment, Dr. Sala, on Richard's skepticism?
Well, I think the important thing for Richard to keep in mind is that in 1952, there was a panel convened. It's called the Robertson Panel. That was convened by the CIA, but it was an interagency panel designed to promote psychological operations concerning the flying saucer phenomenon. And it released a report in 1953 called the Durant Report, and that explicitly says that the movie industry, the entertainment industry, needed to be a prime area for educating the public about the flying saucer phenomenon. In other words, that they were saying quite clearly that they were going to educate the public, in other words, condition them to think a certain way about extraterrestrials and flying saucers and so forth. So right there, you have the link between the entertainment industry and psychological warfare and conditioning people to think in the way the military wants you to think. And one of the things that they wanted to do was to simultaneously put out the idea of this kind of like Star Trek future, but also make it look like entertainment. So it's plausible deniability. That was one of the things they learned very early on. The best way to hide a secret is to hide it in plain sight. So you put it out, but make it look like just a TV show, and there you've got your cover. Anyone saying that, oh, the Navy has a program like this, is saying, no, 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 you're crazy. You're confusing Star Trek for reality.
And remind me, Dr. Sala, I think I've asked you this before, but you've been working on this stuff for probably about two decades, maybe more. What sparked your initial interest in the secret space program, exopolitics? How did you first come to learn about this stuff?
It was in May of 2001. I saw the Disclosure Project press conference that Stephen Greer had organized, and what really impressed me was the 21 witnesses he had, because when I listened to them, every one of them, I knew that they were telling the truth as far as they had experienced these different projects and different things that they had seen with their own eyes. And so I realized that there was a lot of truth here. And as I began digging, I found that there were other people saying very similar things or adding many more details to what they had seen. And so that has taken me on this journey over the last 20 years where now I think I have a fair understanding of the big picture, but you know, all the time I'm learning new things.
And you mentioned William Tompkins as a key source, and I know you edited a book that he had wrote on a lot of this stuff. Is Mr. Tompkins still alive?
No, he died, unfortunately. I believe it was in 2017. He died, but he did publish one book during his lifetime. A second book that he had begun working on that was released last year, and there's a third book that is being worked on right now, and that should be released in another couple of months, and I'm part of the editorial team for that book.
Terrific. I will look forward to reading that. Dr. Sala, thank you for being so generous with your time. I'll look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Frank. Aloha.
Aloha. If people are interested in learning more, getting some of the books, reading some of the articles, seeing some of the videos, you can go to the website exopolitics.org. That's exopolitics.org. My guest has been Dr. Michael Sala. Denunciations straight ahead. Until then, keep asking questions.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everyone, this is The Other Side of Midnight. It's Friday morning. Hopefully you have something fun planned for this weekend. I have a just boatload of things to do this weekend. I feel like that's the case every weekend, but I am looking forward to, you know, being on the same hours as my wife for a day or two because it is tough during the week. She's, you know, she's doing a standard 9-to-5 schedule, and I'm doing the nocturnal schedule. So it can be a little challenging from a relationship perspective. So on the weekend, we kind of we switch to being on the same schedule. But it is Friday. That means a whole lot of you have been looking forward to the list of those that I have denounced or will denounce because it's time for
The Other Side of Midnight presents Denunciations.
And there are a whole lot of people that need to be denounced this week. We begin with the departing Dr. Howard Zucker. I am thrilled. For those of you that don't know, Dr. Howard Zucker is the state health commissioner, and it was announced yesterday that he will be leaving that post. Dr. Zucker was an absolute disaster during the COVID pandemic. In addition to giving inconsistent guidance, in addition to giving guidance that did not go with the science, in addition to being part and parcel to the governor's very poor decision to send COVID positive patients to nursing homes, the more information that we learn about Dr. Zucker, the worse he looks for a guy that was celebrated all over the country during this COVID pandemic. Now it looks like he helped obscure the coronavirus death toll in nursing homes. It looks like he intentionally kept health data from the legislature. Well, I hope his career in public service is over for good. And I hope his career as the health commissioner ends not with a gold watch, but with an indictment, maybe some golden handcuffs. I have to denounce, and it kills me to do it because he is a close friend. I have to denounce my friend, Judge Ron Castorina. Now, Judge Castorina is a civil court judge on Staten Island. He's a friend of mine for 15 or 16 years, and I always thought a pretty close friend. I was for him before anybody talked about Ron Castorina being in public life, before he was a state assemblyman, before he was a commissioner at the Board of Elections, before he was a chairman of the Republican Party. I was a guy that was a huge cheerleader for him, and I made a lot of introductions for him throughout the political community, and I would hang out with him in addition. I was very good social company. And now Judge Castorina is running for state Supreme Court. And I hope he wins. He'll do a great job if he's elected. He had a fundraiser last week, his first run fundraiser as a candidate for state Supreme Court, and he didn't invite me. I got all sorts of photographs from people at that fundraiser, people texting me saying, oh, why aren't you here? We thought you'd be here. We thought you'd introduce Ron. I have supported Ron in every fundraiser he's ever had. Giving him money out of my own pocket, including times it was very difficult to do so. And I didn't even get an invitation to this. So I was pretty ticked off. I was pretty hurt. And I reached out to my friend. I mean, you think about it. It's not exactly as if I'm lacking for things to be at or causes to spend money on, right? I'm not exactly flush with cash at the moment. So it's not the worst thing in the world that I didn't get an invite to this fundraiser. So I ask Judge Castorina, what gives? Why wasn't I invited to your fundraiser? And he tells me, you were. The invite went to your old address. Now, it's true, I did move in October. But one, if he would do a better job at keeping in touch and visiting once in a while or accepting some of my many social invitations over to our house. By the way, the first thing that we did when we purchased our house was put up a Ron Castorina for civil court sign. Then he'd know what my address was. And two, well, if you don't hear back from me, how about a text message or an email or a phone call saying, hey, by the way, Frank, I understand if you're busy, but I just want to make sure you got the invite to my fundraiser. I wanted to make sure you got it. None of that. No follow-up. So I got to tell you, and again, Ron is a good friend. He's a great judge, and he'll be a great state Supreme Court judge. But I'm pretty ticked off, and it kills me to do it. But Judge Castorina, I do denounce you. And I must also denounce the New York City Board of Elections. You know, it seems like every week there's new information that comes out with the New York City Board of Elections doing something wrong. And I think I've been very fair with the Board of Elections. I know my mother works for the Board of Elections, so I'm not looking to beat up on them for no reason. I have a lot of good friends that are at the Board of Elections, and I defend them when they're unfairly beaten up. But a glitch revealed the ballot choices of 378 New York voters, including Dante de Blasio, the mayor's son. So the Board of Elections inadvertently allowed the mayoral primary votes of 378 people, including Dante, to become public. Now, this is outrageous. And the fact that there wasn't a broader outcry about this is amazing to me. Dante said, I am appalled by this violation of my privacy. I don't blame him. I don't blame him. I would be too. There's a secret ballot for a reason. And this glitch allows the identity of who voted for whom to be made public. It's just outrageous. If you're curious, by the way, Dante ranked Maya Wiley as his first choice, followed by Eric Adams, Catherine Garcia, Ray McGuire, and Sean Donovan. Clearly not an Andrew Yang fan. Board of Elections, I do denounce you. I must also denounce Mercedes Parada. Mercedes Parada is a school bus driver in Nassau County. She has been arrested for driving drunk with children on board. This is a 29-year-old woman who knows better. Now, I'm assuming she has some sort of a drinking problem, but in my view, that's no excuse. I'm drunk, you know, most of the day. And the only times I'm not really drunk is when I'm on the air or when I'm driving. Now, you want to be drunk, I think that's your business. But you want to get drunk and get behind the wheel of a car, that is irresponsible, reckless, and criminal. Now, you want to get drunk and drive a school bus filled with children? That is evil. Evil. And I don't care whatever kind of problems this woman has. I hope they throw the book at her. And Mercedes Parada, I do denounce you. I must also denounce Candy Selena Marban. She is a Georgia woman who attempted to drown her puppy because she couldn't afford veterinary services for her dog. Now, there are local groups in Chatham County that are ready to help owners if they can't afford things like food or medical services. Instead, this woman attempted to drown her puppy. Candy Marvin, I do denounce you. I must also denounce Allegiant Airlines. Truth be told, I had never heard of Allegiant Airlines prior to today. But a study by The Points Guy, the website The Points Guy, which I find to be pretty helpful, rated the 10 worst coach flying experiences, and coming in dead last was Allegiant Airlines. Allegiant's seat pitch starts at 30 inches. The airline is most sufferable in the areas of timeliness, cancellations, family accommodations, and frequent flyer perks. So basically everything. So if you want a very poor airline experience, fly Allegiant. I want to denounce the store, and I wish we had the name of this store, but I want to denounce the store that thought it was a good idea in Pennsylvania to have Joseph Sobolewski arrested. It's a convenience store in East Central Pennsylvania. And last month, this is a guy, I think he's homeless. The store had a promotion where two 20-ounce Mountain Dew bottles cost $3. That's what it said on the sign. Two for $3. Let me ask you a question. If you see a sign that says two for $3, what would you think one Mountain Dew costs?
$1.50.
$1.50, Matt Sapienza says. That's why he is relegated to working overnights, because he apparently is as ill-informed as Joseph Sobolewski. Now, of course you would think it's $1.50. That's what I would think it is, too. And that's what Joseph Sobolewski thought it was. So what does he do? He puts $2 on the counter of the store and leaves. But a bottle of Mountain Dew at this particular store did not cost $1.50. A single bottle of Mountain Dew costs $2.29 plus tax. So he didn't overpay by 50 cents as he assumed. He underpaid by 29 cents plus tax for a total of 43 cents. Now, what would you do if you're the store? What I would do is I'd take 43 cents out of my pocket and put it in the register. That's what I would do. Instead, the store employees, I almost can't believe that this actually happened. And this is one of those stories where I hope the early reporting on it is incorrect, because I can't believe that a situation like this exists. And I'm hoping I can come back here on Monday, and after we learn more about this story, I can tell you, oh, that story wasn't as bad as we thought it was. But it looks like it is. The store employees, after this homeless guy shortchanged, I think he's homeless. This homeless guy, Mr. Sobolewski, I don't want to diminish him by just calling him this homeless guy. Joseph Sobolewski shortchanged them by 43 cents. The store employees called the police and they charged him with a felony. He was sent to jail because he has prior felony convictions, and under the three strikes you're outlaw, he was sent to jail on a $50,000 cash only bond and is now facing up to 7 years in prison. The bond was changed 7 days later to a $50,000 unsecured bond. Now, an unsecured bond is granted when the defendant signs an agreement to be liable if they don't show up for court. But you got to understand, this is a guy who shorted a store by less than 50 cents, and now he's being charged under the state's three strikes you're out law. He was convicted more than a decade ago for pumping gas without paying. He was also arrested and sentenced for stealing shoes from Kmart. The shoes cost $39.99. He paid $866 in fines and fees and was sentenced to 3 months in jail for a probation violation. He and his wife were arrested for putting craft supplies in their backpack at a Hobby Lobby. His bond in that case was $2,000. Underpaying for the soda is Sobolewski's fourth charge. This is absolutely insane. Absolutely insane. Brandon Flood, the director of Pennsylvania's Board of Parole, told Penn Live, "For me, I would get the deterrent factor if someone's thefts were getting worse or higher in value. But the lack of discretion is what bothers me. It's problematic because it doesn't factor in the amount." This is nuts. This is nuts. This guy's facing 7 years in prison for underpaying for a soda. I'll tell you, I feel awful for Joseph Sobolewski. If there's a GoFundMe formed for his legal defense, I'm contributing to it. And shame on this store. I mean, what kind of motherless jerks do you have to be to call the cops when you're shortchanged by 43 cents and charge this guy and press charges against this poor guy? He just wanted a soda. How about you have more accurate signage? I want to denounce Washington, D.C. Apparently, according to the National Insurance Crime Bureau, Washington, D.C. has released the National Insurance Crime Bureau has released their 2021 Hotspots report showing the worst places for auto theft in the country. And the very worst place for auto theft in the country is our nation's capital, with 562.98 thefts per 100,000 residents. And finally, I want to denounce Deborah Messing. So she apparently took issue with Kim Kardashian being named one of the hosts for the upcoming season of Saturday Night Live. It was announced yesterday, the new hosts for next season. And the Will and Grace actress wrote Wednesday, "Why Kim Kardashian?" She says she's confused. She goes on to say, "I mean, I know she's a cultural icon, but SNL has hosts generally who are performers, who are there to promote a film, TV show, or album launch. Am I missing something?" Yeah, I mean, you're missing the fact that you're incredibly jealous of Kim Kardashian. Kim Kardashian is one of the most famous people in the world. She is a performer. She is a TV star. She's done just about everything that you can do in public life. So because she wasn't on a sitcom like You, you don't think she should host Saturday Night Live? Excuse me. Saturday Night Live, that's part of what has made it historically so great. It's not so great now. But they have routinely featured hosts who are not actors. Donald Trump, Elon Musk. That was the best episode of last season, Elon Musk. I think it was among the highest rated. Michael Jordan, John McCain. All sorts of folks. Ralph Nader even hosted Saturday Night Live. So it struck me as sour grapes on the part of Deborah Messing. 800-848-9222. That's 800-848-WABC. If you want to comment on any of my denunciations or be heard on anything else.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr., you don't have to be a star. This is The Other Side of Midnight. You don't have to be a star to listen to our show. You can just be interested in quality live and local radio. I believe right now we are the only live and local mainstream talk show in the country right now. There are some news stations that are live. There might be some sports stations that are live. But in terms of mainstream talk or news talk, I think we're the only game in town in the whole country at the moment. I stand to be corrected if that's not the case. 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Baina in Brooklyn. Hello, Baina.
Hi. Hi, Frank. I wanted to, and thank you for having me on. I wanted to ask you only two very brief questions. Number one, or rather, who is in first place to date of the tower cause, please?
Well, it's me, obviously.
Oh, great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Certainly. Also, in regards to what you said of Dr. Zucker, what is it that is that he said that was not of current science during this this disastrous pandemic that we're having? Because you had mentioned that he had said something that maybe the public didn't understand what he said in regards to the science.
No, I don't think the public didn't understand. I mean, I think really you can go to the very beginning, and I'm happy to go back and look at each of the things that he said. I think it would actually be a shorter list would be the accurate things that he said. I mean, from encouraging people not to wear masks at the beginning to, in fact, that was a big thing with him. Now, again, I'm willing to cut people a lot of slack for, they call it the novel coronavirus, for a reason. And we learn more about it as it went. So I don't assume that everybody should have the same degree of knowledge. But, to me, the decision to, make the ventilator issue such a public issue that he and the governor on a national stage talked about New York's terrible need for ventilators when there was never going to be a ventilator shortage. Additionally, the guidance that he gave to the governor about how to use the USS Comfort, I found very, very lacking. So I think from start to finish, this was a very, very poor performance. But aside from all that, the thing that really grates on me is the dishonesty, is the lying to the state legislature and trying to fudge the numbers about how many people died in the coronavirus. So, I mean, that's or nursing homes anyway. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Will in Rockland. Hello, Will.
Hello. Hi, I just want to comment on your denunciation of the store employees with the homeless guy and the soda.
Yes, be my guest, sure.
I'm a retired cop. I was a cop for 20 years, and where I worked, we had our share of homeless people, and some of them are harmless people who've fallen on bad times. Others are chronic trouble for the area that they inhabit, and they're constantly giving their stores or residents trouble, and just, you don't know what the history of this guy is with the particular store. That's my only comment.
Well, that's true. That's true. But still, I think once you call the police, right, if you let's say he is a troublesome guy, he's a nuisance to the store. Let's say that's the case. Once you call the police, and do you really have to press charges over 43 cents? I really think that it's a dramatic, unnecessary escalation. Personally.
Okay. Well, like I said, you don't know the guy's history. That he may be a chronic problem in that store, and this may not be the first time something like this has happened. And just saying it.
Yeah.
You don't know the guy's history.
Yeah, well, that's true. I definitely don't. That is absolutely true. Let me briefly mention this before I run out of time. In fact, I want to mention this before Juliet gets here because I don't want her to get upset because she's a big royal watcher. The governor and the mayor, I was listening to Dominic Carter last night. And I thought he was exactly right. I don't know why anybody makes a big deal about members of the royal family in America. I mean, the whole reason we had a revolution was so that we wouldn't have to care about these people. And yet we still treat them like celebrities. Okay, fine. If people like it, fine. I mean, who's to say someone's interest in royals is any more or less meritorious than my interest in, I don't know, radio talk show hosts, right? The governor and the mayor needed to take a meeting with Harry, who I can't keep track if he's still a prince or not. I think he's the Duke of something. And Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex. They needed to meet with them at the World Trade Center. Why in the world, given what New York is going through right now, would the mayor and the governor need to waste time greeting and then meeting with Harry, who, again, I'll call him Prince Harry for the purposes of this discussion, with Prince Harry and Meghan? This is so ridiculous. And I'll tell you, it's not every day that I can say this. You know who the person is who made the most sense yesterday? Public advocate Jemani Williams. Jemani Williams, who's as far left as you can be, slammed de Blasio and Hochul for still not visiting Rikers Island. And he said, look, if these two people can spare time to hang out with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, they can go tour Rikers. He said on Channel 11, and I'm sorry I don't have the audio, this morning they're showing where their priorities are. I don't begrudge anyone having some fun, but if you're going to make time to go to one world observatory, both the mayor and the governor, you should make time to go to Rikers Island. The guy is absolutely right. Jemani Williams is 100% on the money. I mean, you talk about misplaced priorities. You talk about bad optics. We've had a dozen people at Rikers die this year. We've had correction officers attacked. We have had correction officers refusing to show up to work. We have Rikers is an island in chaos right now. You don't want to be there. As an inmate, you don't want to be there. And as a CO, you don't want to be there. And Bill de Blasio can't even be bothered to visit. The governor can't even be bothered to visit and see how bad it is. But they still have time to meet with Prince Harry and Meghan, two of the most useless people in the world. And again, I don't know Harry and Meghan. Maybe they're perfectly nice people. But in terms of their usefulness for the world, for America, for New York City, I think they're pretty low down on the list of useful entities or useful personalities. But they've got time to meet with these two. Amazing. And yet they still haven't been to Rikers. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-9222. And again, and I know Jemani has potentially a political axe to grind because he ran against Kathy Hochul for lieutenant governor 3 years ago, and he may run against her or Bill de Blasio for governor next year. But he said, symbolism isn't the only thing, but it's important. It's a humanitarian crisis. If it was anything else in the city and state, you would make sure you were there as a leader. Sometimes seeing things for yourself can spur you into action because you actually see with your own eyes what's going on. The guy nails it. And I fully realize that he's a politician with a political axe to grind, potentially. But as far as I'm concerned, he is 100% on the money. As far as I can tell. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Carol in New Jersey. Hello, Carol.
Hey, hi there, Frank. I loved your interview with Dr. Sala. Is he Australian? Because he sounded Australian.
I don't know. I mean, he's in Hawaii now. He lives in Hawaii now. I don't know if he's Hawaiian or if he's relocated there.
I know the accent, so he sounded Australian to me. But, you know, I love The Outer Limits. I used to watch that program when I was a kid. And I thought that they were very prophetic about things now. I mean, I didn't realize it at that time, of course. But they're very prophetic about what's going on. They were. About what's going on now. I love that program. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, no, I was a big fan as well, no doubt about it. I appreciate the call there, Carol. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Jeff in Brooklyn. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning, Frank. I must denounce you.
Oh, boy. I can handle it.
You railed against the Board of Elections for violating the privacy of Dante de Blasio as it relates to his secret ballot. And then you went ahead and said, in case you were wondering, here's how Dante de Blasio ranked his choices on his ballot. So because the Board of Elections did it, and it's in the public domain, that gives you the prerogative to go ahead and do it further. And moreover, you chose to use a 50,000-watt radio station, who at this point its signal may carry as far north as Maine, as far south as North Carolina, as far west as Tennessee, to air a little spat you have with a friend of yours because you didn't get the invite. That's petty, that's small, and that's inappropriate.
Well, Jeff, on your second point, let me begin with that. I do that every week. I mean, that's part of the privilege of having a radio show is that I do that stuff. I mean, that's nothing new. On your first point, there's a huge difference between the Board of Elections, which is tasked with counting votes and administering elections and preserving the integrity of the secret ballot, with them publishing who voted for whom. And then
I'm not giving the Board of Elections.
Well, okay, hang on, Jeff. Hang on.
It's completely inappropriate.
All right. Well, Jeff,
you could have given them a denunciation without further cause, without doing the same.
Well, you might be right. You might be right. I do think once it's in all of New York's newspapers, which it was, that at that point, it's sort of the cat's out of the bag. If Dante was hoping to keep it under wraps, who he voted for, the minute it's in the New York Times, the New York Daily News, and the New York Post, it's over. I mean, I think it's out there.
Well, that's like saying, you know what? A quarter just landed in the telephone booth to me. Verizon's a tremendous company. They don't miss a quarter. It's not even a rounding error. If it's wrong, it's wrong.
Jeff, I don't think that's the same at all, respectfully, but who knows? I'll accept your denunciation. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Michael in Monroe, New Jersey. Hello, Michael.
Thank you. Hey, you know, you're allowed to run for office and say whatever you want. You're allowed to espouse whatever you want. You could be socialist, communist, anti-American, anti-capitalist, blah, blah, blah. And you can even run on that platform. But the one second that you are elected and you put your hand on the Bible and you swear to uphold the Constitution and the way of America, the origination of the founding fathers, and then you govern otherwise, like a Bernie or any one of the members of the squad.
You lost me. What is this?
Right then and there, you are guilty of sedition and treason.
Right, but what does this have to do with anything that we're talking about?
Wait, I'm not allowed to say whatever I want.
Well, go ahead, Michael. You did. There you go. Thank you. Dara is in Saratoga. Hello, Dara.
Hi, Frank. You know I love you, but I got to take you on a few points here. So we know Kim Kardashian is famous for a big hiney and a sex tape, okay? And she's made a lot of that. This is America, and that's a good thing.
Right. She's also got a lot of people out of prison, right? She's also been married to a a billionaire rapper and presidential candidate. She also has a cosmetics line and was on a wildly popular reality television show. And she's released a song that was popular. And she's one of the most famous models in America.
Well, I agree with all that. And I, like I said, this is America, and she's made her way in it. And her father would be proud of her. But what I, in comparison, I think it's a little hypocritical for you to say, and I hope you said this just to be provocative, is Meghan and Harry have done a lot for charity. Their presence at events raised millions of dollars that have been funneled through. They are every bit as much a celebrity as Kim Kardashian. They bring ratings just like Kim does. So I do think that their presence is worth something. And they also have a great initiative right now for mental health and the COVID vaccine, which are two good topics for that the mayor and both the governor are supporting right now. And I think a little something good in the world is a good thing that we need right now. And one other thing, everyone that worked in the early stages of COVID, whether you're talking Governor Cuomo or the doctors or anyone in the government, if you go back into the archives, you're going to see we didn't know what we didn't know then. And I don't think that either one of them got up, Dr. Zucker or anyone got up in the morning and said, how many people can I kill today?
Well, okay, I'll stipulate that that's the case, Dara. But I think you have a tough time explaining either manipulating these numbers in terms of how many people died in nursing homes or concealing these numbers from the state legislature. Again, I'm willing to give him kind of a wide latitude on improper advice or things that were changing with more information. But I really think it looks a lot like deception to me towards the end there.
Well, on the numbers point, I'll give you that much. But you have to think of the political climate that they were working in. And I think that Cuomo went a little bit too much into the politics there. I think that was the one mistake he made in his leadership during COVID. I will give you that point. But as an older person with comorbidities, I credit Governor Cuomo with saving my life because every day I could turn on the TV and get the information that I needed. And I do believe it saved my life, and so does my physician. So I will be grateful. I'm not blinded to their wrong, but I just think we have to cut everybody some slack during this time.
Fair enough. I think, you know, nothing wrong with having a bit of a nuanced view. As far as Harry and Meghan goes, and I appreciate the call, Dara, my issue is less with them, and I didn't know they were doing all that great charity work. If that's the case, great. But my issue is less with them. My issue is with Bill de Blasio and Kathy Hochul. You have a city jail system which is in absolute crisis right now. And yet, they are yucking it up with Harry and Meghan instead of bothering to visit Rikers Island. I'm not saying camp out there. I'm not saying make repeated visits like Curtis Sliwa does, who's actually interested in learning about the problem and maybe solving it. I'm saying visit because, you know, and I was reminded of some remarks that Rudy Giuliani gave to a PBS interview, a PBS documentary about Mayor John Lindsay. Now, John Lindsay and Rudy Giuliani are two very different types of mayors. They were both elected as Republican and liberal. The similarity ends there. Different policy wise, different stylistically, different ideologically. And John Lindsay didn't support Rudy Giuliani. He supported, I think, David Dinkins in 1989. But Giuliani, in this documentary on PBS, talked about a piece of advice that John Lindsay gave him. And I think this is one of the best pieces of advice that one mayor could ever give another. This is, I guess this is from about 10 or 11 years ago. Rudy Giuliani talking to PBS about John Lindsay.
But I really didn't get to know him until those days in which I sat down with him and asked him for advice. And he was very generous in his advice, meaning he spent a lot of time with me. I remember some of the things he told me that really stick out to this day. He said the best way to manage the city is to really be hands-on. He said, don't listen to these people who say you can be once removed. You've got to be involved in all of the agencies. He said the the best way I would ever get results and get things done is when I would say I'm going to go somewhere. So if I said I was going to go to a school, they'd paint the school. And that's how I would get schools painted. And if I said I was going to go look at this transportation project that was taking a long time, all of a sudden the transportation project would work very quickly. Things would start to move. And he said, you have to know how to sporadically intervene, because it will mean a lot more attention is given to that project. The minute they know the mayor is interested, then the entire city bureaucracy puts aside what they're doing and points toward getting that done.
I think that is brilliant. And in some ways, it's the kind of thing that Jumaane Williams is saying. When you're the mayor of New York City and the governor, let alone the mayor and the governor, you have the ability to instantly and single-handedly focus the entirety of city government and the entirety of the New York City press corps on whatever you're doing at that given moment. And when you choose to not bother to pay a visit to Rikers Island, and instead you choose to go yuck it up with Harry and Meghan, that sends the message to the Department of Corrections that changing things up is not important. They'll change it when they get around to it. But if the mayor were to go there, you know, I remember when I was in public school, whenever the chancellor would visit, it would be like a different school. You'd see more, you'd see they'd be very strict in terms of cracking down on filth in the hallways. You'd see they'd be very strict on cracking down on kids wilding in the hallways, kids cutting class. None of that went on. And I would say, well, why don't they just act like it's this way every day? Why don't they just act like the chancellor's coming every day? And the reality is, I guess you can't. But if the mayor or the governor comes, you magnify that by 1,000. And that's the kind of change that you see. And that's what Giuliani's describing there, as told to him by John Lindsay. 800-848-9222. We'll continue with your calls in just a minute. That's 800-848-WABC. A Thousand Stars by Kathy Young. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. 800-848-WABC is our telephone number. If you want to find me on any form of social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or if you just want to email me, you can just go to the website moranovision.com. That's moranovision.com. And you can reach me through there. And if you're on Facebook, we do hope you'll join the Facebook group. Just search on Facebook, Moreno Radio Fans and Haters. Hopefully you're doing something fun this weekend. I am, you know, it's funny. tonight, Friday night, my wife and I made plans to have dinner with her cousin. I believe it's her second cousin. But she's a wonderful woman. She's a reporter. Her name's Kimberly Kravitz. She's actually been a guest on the Bernie and Sid show a couple of times. Great journalist and just a nice woman. And we're having dinner with her and her boyfriend. And initially they were coming to Staten Island, and then there were some issues with vaccination status and so forth. I don't know all the details. So we're going to New Jersey, which is fine. It was great. But, you know, we made plans. So we had plans. And you know, when I make a plan, I try not to break the plan. So that was our plan. We had tonight's date set in stone. And again, I think all my weekends are spoken for until November, maybe even later. And you know, I adhere to my commitment. So That's what happens. A week or two ago, I get invited to this great party tonight at the Friars Club, which is a fun place to hang out. Open bar. This is like a fundraiser for a great charity that helps orphans. $150 a ticket. And the organizer, my friend Zen Sams, she was kind enough to invite my wife and me complimentary to this fundraiser, which is open bar, all sorts of great food. And by the way, crawling with famous people and supermodels, right? It's like a party's party, a great party. But I said, you know, I'm sorry, I can't go. I've already committed. I have a prior commitment. So that's that. So then yesterday, the owner of our radio station, John Katzimatidis, says, hey, Frank, I don't know if you heard, I've decided we're going to do our show on Friday. We're going to do all the programming Friday afternoon, including the Cats at Night show. We're going to do it from the San Gennaro Feast in Little Italy. Now, how much fun does that sound like? And by the way, after the show, I'm going to take everybody out to dinner. So if you're around, why don't you come out to dinner with us? So, of course, now I have to decline that as well. Now, imagine that. Decline the free dinner with the owner of the radio station in Little Italy during the Feast of San Gennaro. So I don't want to be kind of – I don't want to be a jerk when we see Kim later because she's such a nice lady. But how do I properly express that I hope you're enjoying my company at this dinner because I've passed up the opportunity to have an open bar with a bevy of famous people and supermodels and a free dinner in Little Italy with one of the most interesting people in the world who also happens to be my boss. And I think like Commissioner Shea was coming to that dinner, Commissioner Nigro. It was going to be some dinner. So that's what I'm dealing with. Last night, similarly, just to show you I never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, Curtis calls me on the way in. He says, Frank, what are we going to do about this Eric Adams situation? I said, which situation? Well, he says, Eric Adams has called for – he made some comments about Willowbrook. Willowbrook was a home for the developmentally disabled, and – Eric Adams said Willowbrook should have never been closed. I said, what? He said that? He says, yeah. He said, I want you to kind of prepare something for me, a statement or something that we can do from a policy perspective. And I said, no. Here's what you have to do. You have to call Geraldo Rivera and get him to do an event with you on this because he was Mr. Willowbrook. He was the guy that got Willowbrook closed. So he said, oh, well, do you have Geraldo's number? Sure. So I'm going to text it to you right now. So I text him Geraldo's number. That's at around 10:30. Next thing you know, I'm here at the radio station. It's about 11:15, and Arthur Idala calls. So Arthur calls, and I said, you know, hey, what's going on? Arthur says, what are you doing right now? What am I doing? I'm preparing for 4 hours of radio. Arthur says, well, you got to come meet us. Well, who's us? Well, I'm here with your friend Curtis Sliwa. I see Curtis all the time. And then he says, well, I'm also here with Geraldo. And then Geraldo grabs the phone and he starts going on this anti-Eric Adams rant about how Eric Adams is so wrong to close Willowbrook. And I wasn't able to go hang out with them. And it sounded like they were having a pretty good time, believe me. I wasn't able to go hang out with them because obviously I have a radio show to do. But Geraldo did publicly do the right thing in slamming Eric Adams on Twitter for what he was saying on the Willowbrook front. So you can check that out on Twitter if you follow Geraldo Rivera. So he made those tweets after we were and then he took a nice picture, I think, with Curtis and tweeted that as well. And I think that was at least a nice thing showing that Mr. Willowbrook is not on board with what Eric Adams was saying. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Rosemary is in the Hudson Valley. Hello, Rosemary.
Hi. I just want to thank you. You're one of the first, not that I listen to everything, the first journalists, people on the radio to denounce people having fun during the middle of a crisis. It always was my bete noir. I was wondering, it's just me, or when people are yucking it up, as you said, and having fun in the middle of horror. So thank you for mentioning that, Frank.
Well, thank you, Rosemary. But let me just clarify. I'm not against people having fun. I want people to have as much fun as possible. In fact, I think we'd all be better off if everybody was having a little bit more fun. What I'm against is when you send the message to the public that you don't have time to visit Rikers Island while there are 12 dead inmates and correction officers who are not showing up to work or living in fear of being assaulted, spat upon, or having urine and feces hurled at them on a daily basis. You can't be bothered to go there, but you can be bothered to go and pal around with Harry and Meghan. To me, it's the worst kind of misplaced priorities. And again, I know Harry and Meghan do some charitable work. I'm not picking on them. But I feel like the mayor and the governor's time would be better spent elsewhere. 800-848-9222. Until next hour, your influence counts, so use it.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
TGIF, thank God it's Friday. Thank God it's Frank. This is The Other Side of Midnight with you until 5. And then I'm actually going to be with you until 6 because Juliet Huddy and I then bring you the news for another hour. And then Bernie and Sid coming up from 6 until 10. It's interesting. A couple of days ago, maybe it was last week. I don't know when's when. It was Monday. I was telling you the story of how, you know, someone that my wife and I are related to is going through a divorce. And as is often the case with contentious divorces, one of the sides is being somewhat petty, trying to make an issue of furniture and a car and all sorts of other things. And, you know, kind of half jokingly, I said to my wife, you know, honey, if you ever feel the need to throw me out of the house, you can have everything. You can have everything you want, except the thing that I would really appreciate to be able to hold on to is my collection of books, especially my signed books. I you know, I have a lot of things, a lot of stuff, but I don't have that much stuff that really means something to me, right? I mean, most of it is junk, right? I mean, or easily replaceable. So she said, no, you know, you have too many books anyway. I don't know where I would keep them. I don't know what I would do with them. And I was thinking, that's really one of the few things that I would care much about losing in a divorce. And then I thought, all right, well, the books are nice and they have some sentimental value, especially if people have passed on and they've written things to me that are personal or meaningful. But when you think about it, and I think a caller raised this last week, when you think about it, books that you've already read have somewhat limited usefulness. So I got to thinking today, what is the most useful item that I own? The single most useful item that I own. And I gave this a lot of thought. And I'd be curious if you have an answer to that question. What is the most useful, the single most useful item that you own? What is it? So I got to thinking about stuff that I use every day. And the one most obvious, I came up with four. The one most obvious item that I use every day is my laptop computer. I use it for work. I use it for research. I use it for reading. I use it for typing memos. I use it for communicating with email. I use it for work stuff. I use it for political stuff. I use it for personal stuff. And initially that was my thought. Well, that's it. That's it. My laptop computer. It's got to be the single most useful item that I own. And then I thought, well, but if it was smashed tomorrow, wouldn't I just get a new laptop computer and have that do all the same things that this laptop does? Sure, maybe some files, some documents aren't properly backed up. And that was a reminder to myself that I need to do that. So maybe the laptop is not a good pick. And then I thought, many years ago, my ex-girlfriend, Mallory, this is about 10 years ago or so, she gave me a lap desk so that you can, if you're on the sofa or if you're outside, you can put this little mini desk on your lap and put your computer on it, put a notebook on it. And I think it might be that. I think it might be that lap desk that I can use ever, because I use it all the time and my wife uses it too. And it's surprisingly useful. I think that might be the single most useful item that I own. And then the other strong contender that I came up with was I have, both at work and at home, a 40-ounce water bottle. Now, it is very rare to find a 40-ounce water bottle. You very rarely see them in stores. I had to order this special online. But it is so helpful because 40 ounces is a lot of water. And what you do is when you have a 40-ounce water bottle, you can essentially keep this next to you all day and not have to keep running to the water fountain and keep refilling your water cup or water bottle. So that's a pretty useful item. So those are the three that most immediately came to mind. My laptop, my lap desk tray, and my 40-ounce water bottle. What is the most useful item that you own? 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. And then you think really about what is usefulness. Most items you can use for one or two things. And then I was reminded of one of the best books ever written, one of the funniest books ever written, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And in this book, and obviously this book is a send-up, it's a satire, it's a parody. In this book, they make very clear that if you're an international hitchhiker or intergalactic hitchhiker, that the single most useful thing that you can own is a towel. Listen to Douglas Adams, the author of that book, explain why.
A towel is about the most massively useful thing an interstellar hitchhiker can have. Partly, it has great practical value. You can wrap it around yourself for warmth as you bound across the cold moons of Jaglan Beta. You can lie on it on the brilliant marble-sanded beaches of San Trajanus V, inhaling the heady sea vapors. You can sleep under it, beneath the stars which shine so redly on the desert world of Cacrafoon. Use it to sail a mini-raft down the slow, heavy river Moth. Wet it for use in hand-to-hand combat. Wrap it round your head to ward off noxious fumes, or avoid the gaze of the ravenous bug-bladder beast of Kral, a mind-bogglingly stupid animal. It assumes that if you can't see it, it can't see you. Daft as a brush, but very, very ravenous. You can wave your towel in emergencies as a distress signal. And, of course, dry yourself off with it, if it still seems to be clean enough. More importantly, a towel has immense psychological value. For some reason, if a strag means non-hitchhiker, discovers that a hitchhiker has his towel with him, he will automatically assume that he is also in possession of a toothbrush, face flannel, soap, tin of biscuits, flask, compass, map, ball of string, gnat spray, wet weather gear, spacesuit, etc., etc. Furthermore, the strag will then happily lend the hitchhiker any of these or a dozen other items that the hitchhiker might accidentally have lost. What the strag will think is that any man who can hitch the length and breadth of the galaxy, rough it, slum it, struggle against terrible odds, win through, and still know where his towel is clearly a man to be reckoned with.
Now, I know it's tongue-in-cheek, but he makes a lot of good points there. A towel can be an incredibly diverse, incredibly useful item. And I remember my dad still is, at least he was in the past. He used to be very attached to his Swiss Army knife, and he would use that Swiss Army knife for everything. I have a Swiss Army knife, but I rarely carry it. I don't even know where it is, really. But that's something that is pretty useful. So what is the single most useful item that you own? That's the question.
A question. Since before your sun burned hot in space, and before your race was born, I have awaited a question.
1-800-848-9222. What is the single most useful item you own? Neil in Staten Island, what's yours?
Mine is my grab stick. It's a long stick with a handle on the end. When you squeeze it, a little claw on the other end grabs whatever you want to pick up. I'm always dropping things or reaching for something. This way I don't got to get up out of the chair all the time. I just use my stick.
So tell me, Neil, so you keep this grab stick next to you at all times?
I keep it right next to you. I got this chair. I'm in my chair, and I got it hanging on the door handle next to me for the closet. I just pick up the stick if I got to reach something. The phone I keep on the top of the desk. I don't got to get up and pick up the phone. I use the stick, and I grab the phone, and they bring it over to me. I use that stick everywhere. I got one upstairs. I got one downstairs. I got one in my bedroom.
Wow. Now, do you carry it with you if you go out?
No.
Okay.
Just in the house. But I would like to also say, you know, 10 years ago, I saw you with Mallory in the July 4th parade. You went right by the my American Legion Hall. I was yelling at you. Of course, you couldn't hear me. You were in the answer car driving it, and your guardian angel was walking behind you.
Yes, I remembered vividly. That's right. That's right, Neil. I do remember that. All right. Well, thank you. The grab stick. That's one that I wouldn't have thought of. What is the single most useful item that you own? 800-848-9222. Matt, what's your answer to this question?
I'd say you hit it right on the head. The single most useful item that I have is my laptop. But also, I would say my microphone mixer at home, because I do a lot of voiceover work. So I have like a Shure Super 55 microphone, and that's like my most trusty item at my house.
Well, how about you? Oh, and Alex is filling in for Molly today.
Mine is my guitar, I would say. When my hand is not killing me like it is right now with carpal tunnel or whatever I have, I play it constantly. I've like worn down the finish off the neck, and you know, that thing is an extension of my body at this point.
Right. Well, you play a much cooler instrument than I do.
What do you play?
I play the accordion.
Well, I think we can all agree.
That's not a joke.
On that. All right, 800-848-9222. E. Frank in Astoria, what is the single most useful item you own?
Well, once again, I would say, Frank, that I usually have had in years past my keys running all over, so I've always had a set of keychains with marked items inside the chain that protect my keychains, because, you know, if you lose your keys, you can't go into your house, you can't, you know, do anything. So that's the things that have the item that I've owned that has always been on my side.
All right, that's not bad, E. Frank. That's not bad. Ellen writes in the Facebook group, the radio. Now, that's pretty useful. A radio is pretty important. And, yeah, I think that's a pretty useful item. What is the single most useful item that you own? Let's say you're banished to, I don't want to say a desert island, because let's assume it's a place that has electricity and stuff. You're banished, never to return. You can take one item with you, your most useful item. What is it? 800-848-9222. Pete in Hackensack, what's yours?
All right, Frank, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well, thanks.
I would say two things that I always carry. I got my lock blade, 3.5 inch, and my rosary beads. So instead of one, I would go to two.
All right, well, we'll give you that. I like, you know, it's funny. I carry a knife, too, probably about 3 inches, and it's amazing how useful that is and how often that comes in handy.
Oh, without a doubt. And your dad's right with the Swiss Army knife, because although I don't have one, I hit the camping trail once in a while, and there are numerous items that you've got to have. And but those two things I carry around with me, and you know, of course, eyeglasses and keys and, you know, wallets and stuff. But yeah, that's those are indispensable, because I lean on both of those items quite heavily.
Well,
I
get it, Pete. Thank you. And I was thinking about this today too, because I just ordered a pair of binoculars. And it just arrived at the house yesterday. I did this at Dr. Sky's recommendation. I ordered the kind of binoculars that he recommended. And I'm excited to use them. I think that could be a useful item. But if I could only have one item, and I was judging it not on sentimentality but on usefulness, it wouldn't be the binoculars. I have to think it's my water bottle. Radio is a good one. Radio is a good one. It might be the radio. Maybe it's the laptop. Maybe it's the lap tray. Or I'll tell you what the other one that I listed was for me is, you know, I have some personal stationery, which, you know, is kind of nice. And my mom, for Christmas, that's usually what she gives me. She restocks my supply of personal stationery. And I use that just about every day. And one of our great listeners, I believe it was Bridget and Robert Guzzi, they listen from Florida, they got me not only some sealing wax for the envelope, but a stamp, a seal, to have my initials imprinted in the sealing wax. So just about every day I'll send out a letter or something that on that stationery with that sealing wax. So that combination of stationery and sealing wax is pretty high up on my list of useful items. Mike emailing his most useful items is item is the Sony AM/FM digital Walkman. I never leave the house without it. And you know, as he's saying that, and this is kind of the reason that I wanted to do this, because maybe you'd give people ideas of stuff they can get for themselves. Like, who would think to get a grab stick before Neil mentioned it? As he is saying the digital AM/FM Walkman, I am realizing that while I have 9 radios, I don't think I have currently a digital AM/FM Walkman. And I'm thinking maybe I should buy one. You know, because, you know, I have a phone. I usually do that for a lot of radio listening. But, yeah, I'm going to get a portable radio that I can listen to all the time. 800-848-9222. Joe in New Jersey. Joe, what is the single most useful item that you own?
My shotgun.
Ah, quite useful, quite useful. Do you use it mostly for home protection or for hunting or for other things?
Home protection. My wife's a little afraid of it, but like I told her, it doesn't even have to be loaded. If you stand at the top of the stairs and rack it, you know, that's all someone needs to hear, and they're not gonna challenge it.
That's a good one. That's a good one, Joe. Shotgun is certainly useful. Thank you. What's the single most useful item you own? Three open lines if you want to jump on board. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. We're also going to do the $1,000 minute coming up in about 10 minutes where you'll get the chance to answer 10 questions in 60 seconds. And if you do that, you will win $1,000. If you answer a question incorrectly or you run out of time, then the contest is over and you lose. But if you can answer all 10, you'll win. 800-848-9222. Chris in Mount Vernon, what is the single most useful item you own?
Well, I have my multi-tool. I have my Leatherman multi-tool. I love it. You know, I use it so – you don't think you're going to use it, and then I always find a need for it. What's great is my kids, if I need like a Phillips head screwdriver or flathead, I don't have to tell them. They're not going to know what the heck to look for. So I can just say, give me my tool. They know it's my tool. They know where it is. They go get it for me. And you know, let me tell you something. You're gonna need one when your kid is born, because – how many times I have to put batteries and you need to unscrew the little compartments on the toys and all that stuff and open up packages. It's great for everything.
So fill me in on this multi-tool. I'm looking at it now. I mean, it looks kind of like almost like a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, it's similar to a Swiss Army knife. It's a little more heavy duty, and the tools lock, whereas a Swiss Army knife, like, if you push too hard when you're trying to unscrew something, it might like collapse on you and pinch your finger or something like that. So it's a little bit better than a...
This looks cool here. It's a 15-in-1. There's one item here. 15-in-1 multi-tool. You got pliers. You got all sorts of stuff on here. Yeah, this looks pretty neat. I should get one of them.
I have it on there on my belt all the time. Matter of fact, I went to the Yankee game on Saturday when they got blown out by the Indians. And I told my son, remind me not to put it on my belt. Cause I always, the first thing I put on my belt is my multi-tool. I use it every day. Believe it or not, you'd be surprised how often you're going to use it when you get one.
I'm going to buy one now. What was the last thing that you used it for?
Probably for batteries in my daughter's little remote control car. I might have used it to cut open a box because the knife on there is very sharp. I use it for everything. I use it at least once a day, at least.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you, Chris. 800-848-9222. What is the most useful item you own? Alan in Queens. Hello.
How you doing? I would just like to say that at the moment, my most useful item is my phone. I don't know if it resonates with any other of the listeners on the channel, but my phone.
Well, the phone is certainly useful, right? I use my phone for all sorts of things. I use it to look up things. I use it to communicate, to text, to email, to go on social media. But I was thinking that and the only reason I didn't list it first on mine is because if you lose your phone, you just get another one and it's just as useful. But I guess that you're right. It doesn't really take away the usefulness, does it?
Right. I mean, I guess I could understand what you're saying. It lacks uniqueness in that sense because it's so replaceable. But, what I do, I deliver for DoorDash and Uber Eats. So for me, it's basically a very, it's a very necessary thing for me to have. Okay. I know it's not really in a conventional sense something that is unique, but for me, I would say it's my most useful item.
Well, hey, Alan, if that's your answer, that's your answer. I appreciate you sharing that. No question, a mobile phone, especially a smartphone, can be very useful. If you're for Uber Eats, as that gentleman is, or if you're a driver for regular Uber, that's your lifeline, right? 800-848-9222. What is the single most useful item you own? Patrice is in Brooklyn. Hello, Patrice.
Yes, hi, Frankie. It's a cross between my glasses and my clothes.
Glasses and clothes. Okay.
Right. And I wanted to make a a respectful suggestion to you, if I may?
Please, go ahead.
Okay. I suggest that I own my own search firm now, and I've owned it for some time. But as an owner of a search firm, and, you know, I recruit for corporate clients, I would suggest, if I may, if you reschedule the event that you're having with your relatives, if you can reschedule it as such and go to the boss's invitation, did your boss invite you to come to an event with him?
No, it's pretty informal. It's just a dinner. But thank you, Patrice. I don't like rescheduling. Once I've committed to go to something, I kind of like, you know, I kind of think that you should be into it. You know, I think you should enthusiastically participate. And then maybe you're a little bit more careful about overcommitting to things. Joe, here in New York, what's the single most useful item that you own?
Hey, Frank, love the show. Listen, Frank, it's got to be my wallet.
Ah.
Without my wallet, Frank, I'm nobody. It has my credit card, my ID, my business card. It's got everything. It's got a permanent indent in my body. I know when I don't have it. Without it, I can't leave the house. Otherwise, I'm useless. I can't do anything.
You know, it's funny. You're right. That's the only item that I have with me all the time as well. That is quite a useful item.
It's like the Costanza wallet. That thing loses, I'm gone.
You got to see mine, Joe. It sounds like we're kindred spirits.
Absolutely, Frank. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. 800-848-9222. I'll tell you what we'll do in just a couple of minutes. We're going to do the $1,000 minute where we're going to give you an opportunity to answer 10 questions in 60 seconds. If you are the seventh caller to 1-800-848-WABC, that's 1-800-848-9222, and you have what it takes to answer the questions. Once you answer a question wrong, that's it. Contest is over. Or if you run out of time, the contest is over. So if you want to be the seventh caller to 800-848-9222, go ahead and call in right now. Where Are You, Little Star, by The Elegants. Vito Pacone, one of the great singers there. I've interviewed him before. I'm going to get Vito on the show again. He's a great guy and a great, great talent. And it is The Elegants, not The Elegants. So many people call them The Elegants. They're not The Elegants. I've spoken with Vito about this at length. All right. It is time for one lucky listener to try his hand at winning a $1,000, because it's time for
The Other Side of Midnight presents.
It's the $1,000 Minute. Answer 10 questions correctly in 1 minute, and you could win $1,000. Here's your host, Frank Morano.
All right, the rules are simple enough. If you answer a question incorrectly or if you run out of time, that's it. The contest is over. Today's contestant is Fred in Yonkers. Good morning, Fred.
Hello, Frank. How are you today?
I'm good. So I know you're a regular listener and certainly a Little Rascals fan, and you are, I'm sure by now, very familiar with the rules of the contest, right?
Yes, I am, sir.
All right. So you ready to get started?
I'm highly anticipating this experience.
All right. Let's get started, Matt. Who did Joe Biden defeat to become president in the 2020 election?
Trump.
Who is Bernard McGurk's partner on the radio?
Ted.
Name one of New Jersey's two U.S. senators.
Menendez.
That's right. What planet was Superman born on?
This man was born on Krypton.
What hockey player has scored the most lifetime goals?
Wayne Gretzky.
What is the name of one of my three cats?
Mittens.
Oh, unfortunately not. Good job, though, Fred. Good job. I cut Fred off there. Fred, get Fred's information. We're going to send him a hat. Made it up to question six. Three cats, by the way, for future reference. We have...
I think that's a new record.
I think you might be right. I think one other listener might have made it up to six, but that's certainly better than we've had in a while. So, the three cats that we have are Melchizedek, Bathsheba, and Prissy. Those are our three cats. So, that's tough. It's tough, but, you know, if you listen closely, that will come out from time to time. All right. If you didn't get to win a hat, you can go to WABCRadioStore.com, purchase a hat on there. Some other great WABC merchandise as well. And if you want to join us in the Siller Walk on Sunday, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation Siller Walk, you can go to WABCRadio.com/walk and make a small contribution. Oh, by the way, I have to thank one of our listeners that made a monstrous contribution yesterday. This is really incredibly generous, and we don't expect anybody to make a donation like this, but this was phenomenal. But you, and if you want to make a donation, go to wabcradio.com, find my picture, click on my picture. Kevin Monahan donated $1,500, which is by far the largest contribution we've gotten and is incredibly generous. So thank you, Kevin, for that. You have made us all very proud. Thank you very much. And I'm looking forward to meeting you and if you're participating in the walk on Sunday. And I have to get back for my wife's baby shower later in the day. So I was planning on walking. Now I'm planning on running and walking, kind of alternating running and walking so that I could finish at a more brisk pace because I'm going to entertain all the fellas that are going to my wife's baby shower. So that's that. All right, time now for the WABC clip of the day. This comes to us from the Bernie and Sid show. Yesterday it was just Bernie. Sid was off. I think he should be back today. But here was Bernie talking about college.
And it's about working men, men who work with their hands. And this is what I try to tell people. Go get a job. Go to trade school. Forget these stupid, you know, 4-year colleges. Forget the college experience. You're going to go into debt. It's overrated. Go to a trade school. You won't be in debt. You'll learn something. You'll make money. As soon as you graduate, you'll get a job.
Well, look, I can't disagree with what Bernie said there. It's spoken with a lot of wisdom and a lot of life experience. And he knows what he's talking about. So yeah, I mean, if you ask somebody these days, are you more likely to make a living more quickly as either an electrician or a plumber versus being an attorney? I think they would tell you soon enough. It's definitely electrician or plumber. So makes sense to me. It's not to in any way downplay the importance of college. It's still very important. Speaking of Rachel's baby shower, you know, I get so annoyed by people who are vaccinated and still continue to be so nervous about this virus. She has a friend of hers who's in her 30s, healthy as can be, fit as can be, doesn't go anywhere, doesn't leave her apartment, and she's not going to the baby shower because of supposed concerns about COVID. She's got actually three friends like that. And then, well, I mentioned this on air before. Somebody said, well, maybe they just didn't want to go. Maybe it's a convenient excuse. Now, I could respect that if that was the excuse. But they all sent gifts. So it's not just an excuse. They really are nervous. They're all vaccinated. And they're going to be in a room with almost entirely vaccinated people. So I just don't get it. How could you allow fear to so control your life Come on. Live a little. Maybe that's insensitive on my part. I guess it is, but I don't understand it. It's so foreign to me that you're vaccinated and you're going to be in a room with all sorts of other vaccinated people and you are afraid of catching COVID. I don't get it. I don't get it. Although, you know, I'm not going to say where her baby shower is, but it, you know, it's at a restaurant. And one of the people that was attending this baby shower calls the venue and said, are you going to ask for vaccine proof? And this is a person that's vaccinated. And the restaurant tells this person, well, you know, because it's a private party, we'll probably not ask for vaccine proof. And this made this person very nervous. And I would be too. But I said to Rachel, because there are five or six people that can't go because they're not vaccinated, including, you know, some family. And so I said to Rachel, we should try to tell those unvaccinated people that they can come now. And she said, no, 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 I don't want to do that. We told everybody that was coming that under the auspices of they were only going to be vaccinated people there. And she's right. I guess you can't do that. So, but I still, the people that are too cautious with these precautions, it's just, it just comes across as annoying to me. Anyway, but I don't know what the protocol is for me at this baby shower. My plan is I'm going to be at a bar up the block with all the husbands and brothers and boyfriends of the people that are going. And then I'm going to go there towards the very end to help carry stuff and take pictures and meet people and whatever else. So that's kind of my plan as it is now. But we'll see what happens. All right. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Adam was calling in on the subject I raised earlier of the single most useful item you own. Adam, what's yours?
My cell phone. I'm blind, and I listen to you and Juliet every morning, and I really like you guys.
Well, that's nice. You listen on your cell phone?
No, I listen on my radio.
Oh, well, that's nice, Adam. Thank you. Look who just walked in, the man who may very well be the next mayor of New York City, Curtis Sliwa. Curtis, I was talking to you at 11:30 last night. I was talking to you at 10:30 last night. It's now 4:40 in the morning. Have you not been to sleep?
No. I was out at Cary Gardens in Coney Island doing verticals. Checking up on the Bludge Gang there.
What are you doing here at the radio station?
Well, you know, just dropping shit off. You know,
you were dropping shit off?
Yeah.
From Coney Island?
No. Just dropping them off.
All right.
Just doing my Good Samaritan service.
Oh, boy. How's the campaign going?
Campaign's going well, man. I was out there with the Lubavitchers in Crown Heights the other night, Borough Park. You saw me dancing. I mean, it was great. It was great. And then every day, San Gennaro Festival. I'll be there today when WABC is there. Just look for me. I'll be giving you those cards.
All right. So what time are you going to be at San Gennaro if people want to come down and see you?
San Gennaro from about 3 to 6. But I got to be out in Staten Island earlier because I'm going to be at the old Willowbrook Complex, which is now what? The College of Staten Island.
That's right. Victory Boulevard.
2800 Victory Boulevard. If you can be there, meet me at 1 o'clock. And I am attacking my adversary, Eric Adams, who while on Morning Joe with a cup of coffee sitting next to Al Slim Shady Sharpton said they should have never closed Willowbrook. It was just a few bad employees. And that agitated Geraldo Rivera, who exposed Willowbrook when he was the reporter for Channel 7.
I was talking about this earlier, and I saw Geraldo's tweet endorsing you.
So he asked me to come meet him last night. He said, I can't believe he said that. Doesn't he realize that they were injecting the young people and the older people who were housed there with hepatitis? I mean, they were experimenting on these people. They were torturing them.
It's lucky you found someone to give you Geraldo's number. That's a lucky thing.
Very good. Thank you, Frank. By the way, Geraldo giving me tactical air support, endorsing me for mayor, and saying, hey, if you think Willowbrook should have stayed open, you basically, it's like a disclaimer on you being mayor. And he's right. Eric Adams is 60 years old. It's not like he's 30. he grew up with Willowbrook. How could you say that Willowbrook should not have been closed?
By the way, when is your appearance on Morning Joe? Have you been invited on that program?
No, they don't even give me a cup of coffee. And remember, I used to work with Morning Joe.
I remember.
Amica.
Yeah, same
they
here.
They used to follow me here at WABC.
I remember. Yes, no, that
hey,
was
Frank,
right.
Frank, what happened?
They replaced you at 10 o'clock for a time.
They keep saying, you're running for mayor? I thought Eric Adams was already the mayor.
Yeah, well, that's it. All right, well, maybe I'll see you in Staten Island or in Little Italy
yeah,
later.
Yeah, what's
today.
In your backyard?
That's right. I don't want to be institutionalized.
2800 Victory Boulevard, 1 o'clock, come out, protest what Eric Adams said. He should apologize.
Thank you for escorting Sid safely to the radio station.
No problem.
Thank you. All right. Carry on. Go and fight crime and win some votes. We'll do 15 seconds of fame next if you want to start queuing up. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-9222. By the way, I saw Sid came in here. I'm going to ask him off air, maybe even on air. I don't know. I heard him talking about this Muhammad Ali documentary. And I'm a boxing fan. I'm not a boxing expert by any stretch. I just like to watch boxing, right? And so I saw part one. It was a four-part series on PBS. And I'm a big fan of Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker. And I saw part one was on Sunday. But I couldn't watch it because I was at a family function. Then I had to prepare for the show, take a nap, and come here. So then the next day, I was free at the time that it was on. But I didn't want to watch part two without having seen part one. So I said, all right, let me go to the on-demand option on cable and let me see if I can watch part one. No, it wouldn't let me watch part one, which is just so annoying. It would only let me watch part two live. Part one is not available on demand until September 29th. So what does that mean? That means I have to wait until September 29th to watch part one, part two, and part three, and part four. And so ultimately, you know what's going to happen. I mean, that's 5 days from now. I'll get interested in something else and never watch this. So if anybody has seen that Muhammad Ali documentary, let me know if it's worth seeing. I'm going to ask Sid his opinion on it as well. You can email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com, or just go to moranovision.com. That's the best way to reach me through email and through all other forms of social media. And speaking of boxing, Saturday night, I think I'm probably going to end up going out with my wife for our anniversary because our anniversary is next week, but she has some family in town that we're entertaining, so we'll probably go out Saturday. But so I'm not going to order the Anthony Joshua fight. Anthony Joshua is one of the heavyweight champions now. He's got this big fight in England on Saturday, and I would really love to watch it. So I'm not going to order it because I'm not sure if we're going to be at a restaurant somewhere or what the story is. But if you are ordering this Anthony Joshua fight and you live somewhere where it's convenient for me to get to, definitely consider inviting me, and I may come over. And I may bring a bottle of wine or something. frank.morano@wabcradio.com. 15 seconds of fame next. 800-848-9222. Straight ahead.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. 77 WABC.
Before we get to, and it's Bette Midler, before we get to 15 seconds of fame, one last story I wanted to bring to your attention before the WABC early news. Fossilized footprints have been discovered in New Mexico, and these footprints indicate that early humans were walking across North America 23,000 years ago. This came out yesterday. Why is that so important? These first footprints were found in a dry lake bed in White Sands National Park in 2009. Scientists at the U.S. Geological Survey recently analyzed seeds stuck in the footprints to determine their approximate age, ranging from around 22,800 years ago and 21,130 years ago. So these findings may shed light on a mystery that has long intrigued scientists. When did people first arrive in the Americas after dispersing from Africa and Asia? Most scientists believe that ancient migration came by way of this now submerged land bridge that connected Asia to Alaska, based on various evidence, including stone tools, fossils, and genetic analysis. Other researchers have offered a range of possible dates for human arrival in the Americas from 13,000 to 26,000 years ago. This current study provides a more solid baseline for when humans definitively were in North America, although they could have arrived even earlier. So these fossil footprints are more indisputable and direct evidence than cultural artifacts or other more conventional fossils. So it's a pretty big deal. It's pretty exciting. So what they present here is evidence of a firm time and location. And based on the size of the footprints, researchers believe that at least some were made by children and teenagers who lived during the Ice Age. So it's pretty neat stuff. All right. Time for you to be heard for 15 seconds. 1-800-848-9222. It's time for
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
Let's begin with Monica in Westfield. Hello, Monica.
Hi. Have you ever heard of the boxing judge Lou Cavities and Tom A. B's and Boy A. T's and Tom? He is my uncle who judged the fight against Muhammad Ali in Sixth, in which Muhammad Ali lost. Lou Tabbitt.
I'm not familiar with him, but I think Arthur Idala's grandfather was also a judge for that fight as well. But I'll have to check with him. Russell is in White Plains.
With all the negative physical interactions surrounding masks and mandates, why did Borough President Gail Brewer choose to scapegoat three proud black women at Carmine's restaurants? Why?
Jeff in West Islip.
Great song tonight, Frank Sly. The Sly song is my wife's favorite. I want to wish her a happy anniversary. 44 years today. I love you, Peggy.
Oh, happy anniversary. 800-848-9222 if you want to be heard for 15 seconds. Now's the time. Three open lines. Fred is in Yonkers. Hello, Fred.
Frank, for a second there, I thought Superman was born on Uranus. Ho, ho, ho. We want the Floridoris. We want the Floridoris.
All right. Thank you, Fred. Joe in the Bronx. Hello.
For up-to-date news and information on the disastrous border situation, go to UNZ.com. Full details on the massive invasion of our southern border. Again, it's UNZ.com.
Thank you, Joe. Neil on Staten Island.
Orthodox Jews love Curtis Sliwa, and Meghan Markle will always be a lowlife for accusing Her Majesty the Queen of being a racist.
The Irishman in the Bronx.
Hey, Curtis, go up, foil the New York City Transit Authority to get Eric Adams' New York City Transit police records to see the real Eric Adams. And go to support James O'Keefe.
Thank you. 800-848-9222. Joe is in Orange County.
Yeah, Guy I from MFM's a big ball-headed man, and he loves Felix Petrillo. How do you like me now?
800-848-9222. E. Frank is in Astoria.
Yes, Frank, I want to tell you something. I've lived here 51 consecutive years in New York City. The U.S. Constitution seems to have never worked for me or anyone in the city itself. And do you believe that deceased Mayor John Lindsay and the Doors are dictating policy from heaven?
Thank you, E. Frank. All right, that slams the lid on things for the week. All right. Well, this was a lot of fun. Don't go anywhere because Juliette Huddy and I are going to bring you the news for an hour. Juliette is also filling in for Deb Valentine today. So you're going to get a whole lot of Juliette for the next hour, all morning long, really, because that means she's going to be doing the news during the Bernie and Sid show as well. My thanks to Matt Sapienza for a great week of shows, and to Alex for filling in for Molly, who was off today, but she's going to be back on Monday. Well done, Alex. Hopefully we didn't keep you up too late.
I had a great time, as always, Frank.
Wonderful, wonderful. All right. If you want to email me or find me on any form of social media, you can go to moranovision.com. That's moranovision.com. And hopefully I'll see some of you Sunday at the Stephen Siller Tunnel to Tower run. I think we're lining up near IKEA on the Brooklyn end around 8 o'clock, and then we'll go through the Battery Tunnel, or the Hugh L. Carey Tunnel, excuse me, and make it, and then, I don't know, I'll find a way to, I guess, maybe take the express bus back. I don't know. I have to plan my route back. We'll see what happens. The other piece of useful information that I could use, and we got a lot of good suggestions in terms of the most useful item that people own. I have such a tough time remembering my dreams. And I mention this now because I know some of you are just waking up, and I know others are just going to sleep. And some of you may actually be asleep right now, and you've left the radio on, and I'm kind of the soundtrack to your dreams. What always happens is sometimes I'm asleep and I know I'm dreaming, and sometimes I wake up and I'll have a vivid recollection of my dream, and I don't write it down. My wife got me a dream journal specifically so I could write down these things. But the same thing happens all the time, especially on the weekend, which is when I'm most likely to dream, is I wake up and I say, oh, my goodness, that's such a vivid dream. I can't wait to tell so-and-so about it. And I don't write it down because I'm still kind of tired. I'm still half asleep. And I think I'm never going to forget this. I'm never going to forget this. And sure enough, I always forget it. So if there's anyone out there that has some suggestions on how I can remember my dreams, shoot me an email, frank.morano@wabcradio.com. That's frank.morano@wabcradio.com. My thanks to Curtis Sliwa for the surprise pop-in. Hopefully some of you will see him either in Little Italy today or on Victory Boulevard on Staten Island. Have a great weekend. Don't go anywhere. Juliette Huddy has 77 seconds of local news and national news. And then together we have a full hour of news, commentary, travel tips, business updates, sports, traffic and weather on the 7s, or traffic and transit on the 7s. It's going to be a fun morning and a good Friday. Not the actual good Friday, but it'll be a fun Friday. To be continued.